It's showtime.
Bob Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Well, it huffed and it puffed, and it did not blow the house down. Oddly enough, even though the power blinked during the great hillbilly wind apocalypse of the final weekend of February 2019, took out power in a lot of other places and made it blink here. No, we're still here. This here program is live. It is the 25th day of February 2019. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us online. That's the easiest way to get to stream. But, of course, you can also find us at WhiteRoseSociety.org and TuneIn and Roku and Stitcher and Spotify and Podbean. And, gosh, we make it so easy to get the program. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It's Moran Monday. We had sunshine today. I feel whoever wasn't paying the bill for sunshine apparently got caught up, because we got sunshine today and makes all the difference in the world. Oh, yes, it does. So I'm happy to announce, because we start the program with thanks, I'm happy to announce that we have 4 days of fundraising free February between now and Thursday. How awesome is that? Thanks very kindly to our subscribers, Pam in Washington. Thanks to James. Thanks to a brand new subscriber, Mellow Moonlit Meadow. Thank you very kindly to a subscriber of longstanding, our buddy Philip in Maryland. Thank you to Stacy. Thank you very kindly to Arnold. And wait, now we're into we're back into Friday. And then thanks in particular to people responding, because we ended Friday with a deficit anyway, and I put up a post over the weekend, and some people responded. Thank you very kindly to, let's see, did I get that? Yeah, James and Asa and Kay and Samson and Ralphs and Vincent. No, Vincent there. Vincent jumped in and did a Have a Show on Me. And then there was Randy, who jumped in and helped. And Tracy jumped in and did a Half a Show on Me. So we are done. Thank you so very much with fundraising for the month of February, and there's nothing left now to do except thank all the subscribers for the remaining few days. So thank you very, very much indeed. We made it. That's awesome. And so we can take a little bit of a breather. Bills got paid. Oh, there was a frenzy of bill paying. And so now we'll just start sweating March, but we're not going to start sweating until Friday, when, you know, my money is on rooting for March to come in like a lion, so it'll go out like a lamb. You know, I believe in all of that old geezer wisdom sometimes, and some of it seems to work. So maybe climate change won't turn it into March comes in like a lion and goes out like a thundering Tyrannosaurus Rex or something like that. That's where my hopes are. Now, here we are. It is Moran Monday on the Horn. Oh, dear Jesus. We got plenty of them. And I've got a program note for the evening as well. Here in about, 55 minutes or so, we're going to be joined by my good friend and your good friend, Dan Fisher, movie and television, technical craftsman, and longtime aficionado of film and TV, and we're going to we're going to deconstruct the Oscars from last night. Yes, yeah, I know. We do a lot of serious policy stuff, and sometimes we carry on and we cuss and we deal with a lot of really sordid and serious issues. But sometimes we have to get a little shallow. Interestingly enough, though, with the Oscars last night, it's not so shallow. No, it's not, because we live in the age of Julius Caesar's reign over the United States of America. So we can't be so even an awards show turns into a political adventure. But it is indeed that time, the beginning of the week, the first day of a new week, when we celebrate the idiocy that has transpired over the course of the preceding weekend.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up, step right up. You will not believe your ears. It's Morin Monday on the Horn. Yes, indeed, just a few mere meager steps off the Carnival Midway, you'll find the Morin Monday tent over here. Not too far from the little booth where you can throw ping pong balls at goldfish bowls in a desperate attempt to win a little tiny iguana that will eventually be the size of a Volkswagen Beetle and perhaps eat the rest of your pets back at home. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. The Morin Monday tent is free, but the fact of the matter is the people who follow the carnival often kick in $10 a month so that every hour of programming works out to be about less than 16 cents per hour. You can't tell the morans, but this is the program that tells the morans, and you can't tell them much, right? I screwed that one up real good, but that's all right. That's all right. I'm fighting off the February me grims, and nothing like a bunch of morans to sort of get you through. An advisory goes out to folks entering the Morin Monday tent, this thin cybernetic veil. Inside, we've got them all. Birchers, deathers, ninthers, tenthers, booger eaters, libertarians, maggots, trumpanzees, Republicans, the whole spectrum of white wing weirdness on display for you just beyond this thin cybernetic veil. Indeed, indeed, indeed. Of course, an advisory must go out. People entering the Morin Monday tent should be careful to keep their hands on purses, wallets, bracelets, jewelries, rings, necklaces, earrings, various and sundry facial piercings, children, other small pets, even the iguana, European-style messenger bags, backpacks. Yes, because the morans, being conservative, can get grabby. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in morans. Oh, yes, yes, you will indeed. And I'm challenged to figure out where to begin. So why not a little bit of Minnesota nice? There's a member of the state legislature up there named Representative Cal Barr, B-A-H-R, Barr. Mm-hmm. And according to the Twin Cities Pioneer Press, this past Saturday, he was invited to speechify to the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus rally, because there's a couple of different gun control proposals headed for the state legislature. Well, he spoke for a little bit, but then the real Cal Barr came out. Oh yes, it did. Get the hockey pucks, because it's more in Monday.
And another one of those socialist states out east. You can kind of pile a lot of them together that way, right? They know how to run your life, not you. They think you're too stupid to make your own decisions. So that Representative Drazkowski's list, all those phobias, he forgot an important one. Freedom of phobia. That's for people who can't make up decisions in their own life. They need that government entity to tell them how to live their life. Because they can't do it themselves. Not like the people in this room. We are responsible people. We know how to take care of ourselves. We take care of our neighbors, and we take care of our communities.
Darn tootin'. And if we see a problem, we shoot it. Right? You betcha.
So I read off this long list of infringements on our Second Amendment rights, our rights of personal defense, and as others have mentioned, the right of defense against a tyrannical government. Some days, you know, you feel like the frog in the boiling water. Just exactly how long are they going to just keep notching it up, a degree here and a degree here and a degree here, until you've had enough? That line is for each of us to decide, each on our own terms. There you go. There's a lot of us in this room that have had enough, and it's time to start riding herd on the rest of these people that want to take your rights away from you. They will not go quietly into the good night. They need to be kicked to the curb and stomped on and run over a few times.
That's right. They need to be kicked to the curb and stomped on and run over a few times, dear. Absolutely, because that's what democracy is all about. If you don't like what somebody's saying, you kick them to the curb and you stomp on them until they learn to keep their filthy liberal socialist commie pinko mouth shut. That's what you do. And then you pistol whip them a little bit and you ask them if they've had enough. And when they say yes, then you hit them in the head a few times with the butt of your rifle gun. Der hey. Absolutely. Oh, wait. Der hey. That's a Wisconsin thing. Sorry about that. Der hey. And listen to the maggots just clap. Ooh, they love it. Oh, they love it when they hear about people going to stomp the libtards. Eww, weird doggies. I'm beginning to think there's certain portions of the upper Midwest that are just Alabama with worse weather. Yeah. Wow. Quality. So, it didn't play real well in certain quarters. Democratic Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said, encouraging violence endangers our communities and undermines our democracy, particularly when the statement is made by an elected official. While heated debates are a healthy part of the political process, this type of language is unacceptable and demands condemnation from people of all political parties. Well, yeah, except for IOKIYAR, except for morons. They're special. If they get aggrieved, they get to start talking about stomping people. Meanwhile, down in Texas, you just knew that. You knew we weren't going to stay in Minnesota, didn't you? Oh, you betcha. Meanwhile, down in Minnesota, or down in Texas, not Minnesota, you might recall that for some time now, I have been preaching an idea. Not preaching, come on, Bob. I've been discussing the notion that come, say, 2020, we have to dare to dream. We have to imagine a world without Republican senators. a world where we throw Mitch McConnell out of office, and we send his chief henchman, John Cornhole, along with him. Because they're both up for re-election in 2020. It's my personal hope that there will be a vibrant Democratic candidate to run against John Cornhole, because it's beginning to look like he might be he might have some tendencies that we're not real fond of here in Merca. Or at least we didn't used to be fond of, or at least that we used to mobilize the entire nation to fight against. It was Saturday. It was yesterday. It was yesterday when Senator John Cornyn, at John Cornyn on Twitter, J-O-H-N-C-O-R-N-Y-N, if you want to look it up for yourself, it was yesterday, Sunday, when John Cornyn took to the Twitter machine and posted, and we've all done this, that there are various quotes that some of us are fond of that mean something to us. I like that, for instance, I like that quote, and I use it from time to time in my email. I like that quote about how a man doing well at the upper ends of a prosperous industrialized society can hardly hear his conscience at all. That comes from Kurt Vonnegut. John Cornyn is not a Kurt Vonnegut fan, as far as I can tell, because, among other things, Kurt Vonnegut actually fought in a war, the Second World War. He was captured at the Battle of the Bulge, marched his ass all over Europe, wound up in a prison camp in Dresden in Schlachthaus Nummer 5, Slaughterhouse 5, hence the name of the book, and saw the devastation of an unnecessary bombing on a civilian population and became a rather anti-war thereafter. Well, not so for John Cornyn, who's probably never heard a shot fired in anger. John Cornyn has a different hero from that era, and on Sunday, he tweeted, quote, "We were the first to assert that the more complicated the forms assumed by civilization, the more restricted the freedom of the individual must become." Close quotes. Benito Mussolini. I guess we're there now. The GOP has been playing footsie with fascism and getting well beyond footsie into downright slap and tickle with fascism for a couple of generations now. And now they're just there. Affirmatively quoting Benito Mussolini. "We were the first to assert that the more complicated the forms assumed by civilization, the more restricted the freedom of the individual must become." Howdy-do. This is 2019, right? I'm just checking. Because back in, say, the 1930s and 1920s, there were Americans who thought that old Benito there just was so awesome that he shit ice cream. I think, in particular, say, of the father of former Supreme Court Justice Fat Dead Tony Scalia. Fat Dead Tony's fat dead daddy was the chairman or the president or the Il Duce or whatever you have of the Benito Mussolini fan club in America. And he raised his son accordingly. And so, like I said, in the 20s and 30s, we had people who were seduced by fascism. Henry Ford, for instance. Or maybe the Bush family, who helped make money for a guy named Fritz Thiessen, known as Hitler's Angel. But you know all this. The IBM, UBM, we all BM, turned out to be fans of the Dritte Reich. But it's been a while since that happened. I mean, like, almost 100 years. 80-ish. And I'm sure that some folks... Yeah, you're right. Randy and PA adding to the list. Or Lindbergh. Yes, I just got back from talking to that charming Mr. Hitler. Yeah. Or Joe Kennedy. Father of John, father of Joe, father of Bobby, father of Teddy. Joe was a big fan of that Mr. Hitler. It proved a bit of a problem when he was appointed to be the ambassador to the court of St. James there in London. We've had our fascist fascinations. But it's been a long time since I've seen anyone who wasn't a subscriber to, like, Stormfront or Daily Stormer or a Proud Boy or any of those sick, bizarre, twisted groups positively tweeting about quotes from Benito Mussolini. But hey, it's 2019. He's a Republican. Russian tool is in the White House, and for all we know, John Cornyn got some of those sweet, sweet rubles that passed through the National Ruble Association. So, yeah, go figure. Yeah, he's apparently a Mussolini fan. Desperately trying to clean it up for him, someone said, it appears he's warning us against an overly powerful central government, but it'd help if he'd clarify. To which he responded, Cornyn, or some weird little ahistorical troll that works for him. Yeah, you nailed it, bud. Since so-called democratic socialists have forgotten or never learned the lessons of history and how their ideology is incompatible with freedom, I guess we have to remind or teach them. The only problem is, Benito Mussolini expressly and explicitly rejected fascism and socialism. That's one of those things that you can discover with a fairly simple internet search or by reading some hard copy books. Benito Mussolini was the inventor of fascism, named after the Fasces, the bundle of rods and axes that the lictors, L-I-C-T-O-R-S, who were the bodyguards of high-ranking Roman officials, would carry so that they could beat the snot out of anybody who happened to get near the said Roman office holder. They took that name, fascism, because, well, one of the things that they did was that they the fascists formed up into gangs of bully boys, and they went around and beat the holy snot out of anybody who had the temerity to disagree with them. That was fascism. It was later defined by Benito Mussolini, who far more than say the little short dude with the Charlie Chaplin mustache was actually kind of a thinker. He defined fascism as a marriage, if you will, of the vast power of the state and the vast power of private corporate business entities. Does that seem at all familiar? Is that sort of tickle a neuron or two? Yeah, why, yes. As a matter of fact, it does. because that has been the operating philosophy of the Republican Party, bowing and scraping to business in America for pretty much most of the modern era. It's why we cut taxes on corporations and let the government shut down so that people who work for the government wind up going to food pantries. And commerce secretaries say, well, I don't know why they don't just go out and borrow $1 million. That's what I do. But it wasn't just John Cornhole. No. Little dude from Miami. Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio sent out a tweet yesterday, and it was a real Lulu, too. Marco is getting really, really excited at the prospect of sending some other father's children, some other mother's children, to war in Venezuela. And so it was yesterday that he posted a pair of photographs. One was a photograph of Muammar Gaddafi, green shirt, white jacket, groovy shades, sitting at some event, looks like he's on a sort of throne-like thing. The other photograph is of Muammar Gaddafi. It's apparently a screen cap of Muammar Gaddafi after a group of, Al-Qaeda affiliated thugs got hold of him back during the Arab Spring. At which point in time they sodomized him with a bayonet and eventually murdered him. And so the screen cap that Marco Rubio posted was of an apparently, it looks like he's still living, but not for much longer because he's soaked in his own blood. And he's being held up by one of the people who murdered him. Not that I got all misty-eyed about Muammar Gaddafi. Pan Am Flight 103 was enough to put paid to that. But apparently, and remember, of course, that Marco Rubio is a good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, amosexual. Apparently, it got young Marco real excited in his Rubio places. And the reason he tweeted that was because he's getting excited at the thought of doing that to Nicolas Maduro, you know, sodomizing him with a bayonet, in Venezuela. Yeah, sorry, 6:29 p.m. That's not a time check. Just noting that apparently dinner is taking it on the chin in the Eastern Standard Time Zone this evening. So, my apologies. But the yearning for bloodshed and death among the fascist Republicans, what did I say about bully boys there a few minutes ago, is getting strong with these ones. And I might piss some people off, but history is what history is. Historian Kevin Cruz tweeted in response, Just a U.S. senator tweeting out stills from a snuff film. Nothing creepy about that at all. Yeah, of course not. But the trouble with having a functioning memory and rather a halfway decent one at that. Yeah, Monique, you're absolutely right. These people have the same mentality as those who commit prison rapes. Ugh. Well, it's not the same. Not the same mentality. I mean, yeah, they got that, but it's the same. It's the same everything. They're thugs. I mean, there might not be a whole lot to Marco Rubio. You might be able to buy him for what he's worth and sell him for what he thinks he's worth and never count the loss. He might be so tiny that he has to run around in the shower to get wet. He might be so puny that if he stands sideways and sticks his tongue out, he looks like a fucking zipper. But they all share in common a keening, a yearning for other people's blood, whether it be in Venezuela or whether it be in Iran, whether it be a Venezuelan leader's blood or the leader of God knows how many countless poor people who still support Nicolas Maduro. Because whatever else you say about the issues in Venezuela, one thing is true. Both Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro maintained the support of the poorest of the poor in that country, largely because so many generations of Venezuelan leaders hadn't. Hugo Chavez never could have gotten into office and thereby could never have passed power on to Nicolas Maduro had not the poor in Venezuela been treated so with such utter neglect, such absolute disdain, so entirely shabbily by leaders before them. It's also worth noting that the people who continue to support Nicolas Maduro are not like the people who we are routinely shown on the multimillionaire for-profit media, insofar as that in the attempt to shape the narrative, the people on the multimillionaire for-profit media that we see, they're mostly white folks. The people who continue to support Nicolas Maduro are, in many cases, often brown folks. That might tell you a little bit about the income inequality and the root causes of the way people feel and who feels how as well. Yeah. Jesus, it's sickening, isn't it? But there is a hard on for a war in Venezuela, and apparently Colombia is now a partner in peace as we're staging a bunch of evil shit there. But what I said a few minutes ago, I'm probably going to piss somebody off because I'm going to go ahead and say this. Because history. The business with Gaddafi and Rubio's penchant for snuff porn. Well, it comes with something else. I'm surprised I haven't seen it in email yet. After Gaddafi was killed, someone else remarked upon his passing. It's just a fact. We have to be grown up enough to deal with facts. And that is something else that occurred at the time that Gaddafi was killed. A lot of people were called upon to comment on his death because he had been a thorn in the American side for a very long time, and in fact had a hand in the murder of all the people aboard Pan Am Flight 103, among other things. But we had struck a deal with him. He had promised to do certain things, we had promised to do certain things, and, well, it kind of seemed to be working there for a little bit. But I guess not so much. And what I'm thinking of in particular is something that, and make no mistake, if this individual was president of the United States right now, we would be manifestly better off than we are now. But you don't just, it would be dishonest to sweep something down the memory hole like this.
So, I mean, that is the land of unconfirmed.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
No, I'm sure it did.
Yeah, sorry. But that was Hillary Clinton. We came, we saw, he got sodomized with a bayonet. That was one of the things that, well, she had a talent for saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. Sorry. We got to deal with reality here, even if no one anywhere else does. Subject line Scott, or subject line from Scott in San Diego, Rubio et al. Coming soon to a theater of war near you, from those folks who brought you America's colossal clusterfucks in Afghanistan and Iraq, Operation Venezuelan Oil Grab. What is all of America's oil doing under all that Venezuelan dirt and water? I just don't know. As Arnold just put it by message, gotta get with the program. Or get dead. We killed them because no central bank. Arnold said, I knew you were going to play that clip. I just knew it. I hate it when I'm predictable like that, but that's like talking about Pearl Harbor and not playing the FDR clip saying, a day that will live in infamy. But there was another clip that made a hell of a lot more rounds. What's that? Ron and Raleigh, don't forget, remember that Venezuela is only the first stop on the Trump regime overthrow tour. Next comes Cuba, then Nicaragua. Once we've gotten some practice, then it's on to Iran. And by the way, do not look to this program for a discussion of R. Kelly this evening. Not because it doesn't matter, but because there's nothing to report. The thing will make its way through the criminal system. And then we'll see if the criminal system works well enough to do justice. Now, if I was going to run off with a lonely little $5 bill, well, a pair of lonely little $5 bills, to say, oh, Harris in Reno, I'd put one $5 bill on Robert Kraft pays no penalty, does no time for participating in not only prostitution, but a non-consensual human trafficking and sexual slavery scheme. No, he'll get away with it. I might even add a $5 bill on, and the NFL does nothing to him either. Because after all, the shit that'll things that will not get you in trouble in the NFL, things that will get you welcomed, things from which you can be welcomed back with open arms. Prostitution. abusing and physically assaulting women in various different forms. Yeah. The only thing that'll get your ass bounced out of the NFL is smoking dope or kneeling during the national anthem as a form of protest against the number of African-American and particularly African-American young men who are regularly and routinely slaughtered by the police. That shit will get you bounced. Pay attention. On the other hand, I'd take my other lonely little $5 bill and put it on, they will do everything in their power to put R. Kelly away forever. And that is without, that's, there's no commentary there on whether he has it coming. It is merely a commentary on the sort of different way that the criminal system works under different circumstances. You see what I trust you see what I mean. But like I said, there was other video going around, and everybody apparently had an opinion about it. And it is, in particular, this confrontation between some young people who are part of an organization called the Sunrise Movement, and of all people, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. Now, let's remember, Senator Feinstein is like a million years old or something. I mean, she's like 89, 90, isn't she? Yeah, it's the... And the Sunrise Movement is a political group that was founded by, if I'm not mistaken, and I think I'm not mistaken, some former Bernie staffers, and they got some, you know, they got some free office space from the Sierra Club, and they got $50,000 from somewhere else. And so last week they went after Dianne Feinstein. Now today, bless their hearts, today they went after somebody who mattered. Today they went after Addison, a.k.a. Mitch McConnell. Which is kind of where any such pressure is going to have to land. And if you want to make somebody look bad, it's not real hard to make Chinless Mitch look bad. On the other hand, however, the big deal was the showdown with Dianne Feinstein. And because Twitter only allows two-minute clips, the Sunrise Movement was only able to post 2 minutes worth of the confrontation in which these kids went to demand that Dianne Feinstein sign on to their Green New Deal. Now, yes, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez sponsored it. I mean, okay, let's be clear about something, because I know a lot of people are paying attention to the Green New Deal. I support it in principle. But there isn't any legislation. Not a single bill associated with the so-called Green New Deal has been introduced, to the best of my knowledge. Instead, it's a mere resolution that has no legal force in effect, and it's been introduced in the House and the Senate. In the Senate, it's under the purview of its sponsor there, Ed Markey of Massachusetts. And it is being used, you know, Chinless Mitch got in a real hurry to come out and say, oh, we're going to vote on the Green New Deal. I want these goddamn Democrats to stand up and say that they don't want Americans to be able to eat hamburgers or drive cars anymore, because that's what the Green New Deal's about. Yeah, my old Kentucky homie, Mitch McConnell. So they're going to be voting on it. Even though it's a meaningless resolution that won't even, that if it passes, won't be anything. It'll just be another thing that the Senate muttered something about. And so this is the, you know, this is that moment.
On the Green New Deal.
Yeah, okay, so that's outside the building. And what you're hearing from there are a couple of little girls. Probably can't be much more than 10 or 12. And you'll notice that they know what their message is. They've been well taught. They're sharp kids. You'll notice they refer to her not as Senator Feinstein, just Feinstein. I'm not one of those people that gets all squishy about ceremony and forms of address and things like that, except to say that I do have about 7 years of experience working about the only climate change bill that's in the House of Representatives. That, of course, is the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, the AHEC Act. And we've learned some hard lessons along the way because we're not professional lobbyists. You know, we're not pulling down buku bucks like some former House or Senate member who's gone to work for some lobbying firm. We're just hillbillies who occasionally scrape up enough goddamn nickels to get to Washington, D.C. and eat beans for a week and work our asses off pounding the halls of Congress, begging people to please pay attention to the 900 people per year who die in West Virginia's mountaintop removal counties because of mountaintop removal. And we've learned that, yeah, sorry, you really do. You kind of got to go in, and this is for adults, mind you. You kind of got to go in dressed like you're doing business. Slacks and a sport coat and a shirt and a tie for guys, or a suit, even better, for guys. Nice dresses or pantsuits or combinations or whatever for women. And when referring to the representative in question, use their name. Refer to them as congressman, congresswoman, representative, senator. Because it's stylized. It's formal. I kind of wish somebody would have... Because I want these kids to succeed. And here's what's interesting. Senator Feinstein actually came out and talked to them. Senators don't do that. That's actually a sign of being approachable and engageable with your constituency. Maybe because it was kids. I don't know. But for the most part, when you're doing this kind of work, you talk to a legislative aide or the legislative affairs director, or you talk to the environmental LA or the human health LA or somebody who's on staff or a newly minted PhD who has a PhD in some relevant topic. And so you're sort of, it's like that game of telephone, and you hope they get it right. And sometimes they sit there and they take notes and they pay close attention to what you're saying. And sometimes they sit across the table from you. I'll never forget one day when an aide to someone who was running, a Democratic senator who's running for president, sat there and played with her hair. Never wrote a goddamn word down, just sat there and played with her hair. And that's when you know you're not getting through. Ron in Raleigh notes, subject line, Di-Fi breaks bad. Di-Fi is 86. She will be 98 when the 12 years we have left is over. Di-Fi jumped all salty with these little kids. She, in essence, told them to get the fuck out of her face because she's been doing this for 30, and she wasn't listening to some snot-nosed kids. That is certainly the message that they wanted to get out there. That was the image that they wanted to convey. Now, what's interesting is that she did say that she might sign on to the Green New Deal resolution. In 7 years of begging senators to introduce the AIC Act in the Senate, companion to the bill that already was introduced in the House, we've never gotten a might. We've gotten,
well, what does Joe Manchin think?
At which point, you know that everything's dead in the water because they're going to bow and scrape to Joe fucking Manchin instead of giving a damn about the aforementioned 900 people who die in West Virginia's mountaintop removal counties every year. Monique with a good question. Shouldn't these kids be starting with House members? Well, I mean, it's been concurrently introduced in both House and Senate, so I think it's okay to work either House. The difference being that you've got a fighting chance of getting the resolution passed in the House, whereas there is not a chance in hell that this passes in this Congress in the Senate. Zero chance. If it was possible to have a less than zero chance, the Green New Deal resolution, which isn't actually even a statute or a law, has less than zero chance. That's not me poo-pooing their efforts or their desire or their determination. That is me acknowledging the reality of what Chinless Mitch McConnell, a.k.a. Mitch, real named Addison, is going to do. Mitch is going to maintain his coal-blackened death grip on this country and this country's future until such time as the people of Kentucky make him take his hands off of it, or the god he worships does. Presumably worships. I mean, that's just a fact. If Chinless Mitch, for some reason, were to, by some natural process, were to breathe out and not breathe in again, John Cornyn, the aforementioned Mussolini fan, would step into his position and do the same thing. Darlene in Connecticut with a note. Feinstein could have used that as a teaching moment with the children, discussing the difference between a resolution versus a bill, etc. Instead, she blew it with these younglings. Could have fooled me that she has 7 grandchildren of her own. Well, hell, her 7 grandchildren are probably 60. Wonder how often she actually engages with her own grandkids. Her resistant, arms-crossed, cocky school marm attitude was pathetic and deflating. Feinstein looked uncomfortable. Jesus, be a little nicer and act like a grandmother at least. They are her constituents, after all. Kids can really reveal someone's true character. We'll see if she signs on to the Green Dream, as Pelosi acidly called it. This is some serious shit if you have kids begging for their representatives to hear them. It is serious. It's their future. It's not Dianne Feinstein's future. Dianne Feinstein is probably not going to live to see the outcome of the 30 years that she has spent more or less ignoring climate change. She's not going to see the outcome of 30 years of half measures, 30 years of control of both houses of Congress, not by Democrats or Republicans, but by coal companies and gas companies and oil companies. She's not going to see any of that. But if those little girls are 10 years old, when they get to be DiFi's age, it will be nearly the year 2100. Everyone within the sound of my voice will not be here, myself included. But we will have left to them a nightmare to deal with. And if they hate every last one of us for what we did not do, sad to say, but we probably will have earned it. Oh, sure, you and I can sit here and talk and say, well, hell, we tried. We busted our asses. We acknowledged the science. But we were ineffective in getting done what desperately needed done. Regarding Senator Feinstein, Scott in San Diego says, the reaction toward the visiting kids by her esteemed crankiness put me in mind of the young missionary Mark Twain once wrote about. He went out among the cannibals. They listened with the greatest of interest to everything he had to say and then ate him. When it comes to Dianne, Mr. Rogers, she ain't. So let's go back and see if we can run this clip without me running my mouth.
Trying to ask you to vote yes on the Green New Deal.
Please. Okay, I'll tell you what. We have our own Green New Deal.
Some scientists have said that we have 12 years to turn this around.
Well, it's not going to get turned around in 10 years. What we can do.
Senator, if this doesn't get turned around in 10 years, you're looking at the faces of the people who are going to be living with these consequences.
The government is supposed to be for the people and by the people and.
You know what's interesting about this group is I've been doing this for 30 years. I know what I'm doing. You come in here and you say it has to be my way or the highway. I don't respond to that. I've gotten elected. I just ran. I was elected by almost a million vote plurality. And I know what I'm doing. So, you know, maybe people should listen a little bit.
I hear what you're saying, but we're the people who voted you. You're supposed to listen to us. That's your job.
How old are you?
I'm 16. I can't vote.
Well, you didn't vote for me.
Well,
I'm
24.
It doesn't matter. We're the ones going to be impacted.
Well, mean something.
It doesn't matter. We're going to be the ones who are impacted.
I understand that. I have 7 grandchildren. I understand it very well.
Senator, the cost of not taking this action is far higher than the cost of what the Green New Deal will be. And
here's
there is enormous popularity for this bill around the whole country.
Here's
and we're asking you to be brave and do this for us and for your grandchildren.
Get enough for everybody. I'm trying to do the best I can, which was to write a responsible resolution.
Any plan that doesn't take bold, transformative action is not going to be what we need.
Well, you know better than I do.
See, that right there. Any plan that does not take bold, transformative action is not going to be what we need. Now, this is a young woman. She's been if I understand, and I've been involved with these kind of processes before. Oh, believe you me. By the time you get into that office like that, you have been told precisely what to say, when to say it. You've been given your talking points, and there's somebody from the overarching organization who is there to make points like we need bold, transformative action, et cetera, et cetera. And you know what? She's right. She's absolutely right. We do need bold, transformative action. Guess what the Green New Deal resolution isn't? That's right. Bold, transformative action. It's not any action at all. There is not a single governmental requirement in it. It's just an expression of hope. As far as I know, really, the only climate change piece of legislation with a chance to impact climate change that's in the House of Representatives is the AIC Act. Now, I guarantee you, nobody in, and please understand, this is not me complaining. This is just a fact. Nobody there in the Sunrise Movement knows the first foggy thing about the AIC Act. Not one of them. At all. They don't know about 900 dead hillbillies a year. They don't know. They don't know about the cancer, the heart disease. They don't know about the birth defects. They don't know about the mental illness. They don't know about the more than two dozen, approaching 30 peer-reviewed, published science journal articles documenting everything that we talk about with regard to mountaintop removal. They don't know. They don't know that probably the easiest lick to hit in the battle against climate change would be to shut down mountaintop removal. They don't know. How much more wonderful would it have been if Senator Feinstein would have stood there and said, here, let's go. I'll walk with you. Let's go to Senator McConnell's office, because he's the problem. And when we're done in Senator McConnell's office, I'll take you to Senator Cornyn's office. And when we're done in Senator Cornyn's office, I'll take you to Lisa Murkowski's office, because they're the problem. They're the people who think that climate change, who agree with Donald Trump that climate change is some sort of Chinese hoax to steal all our golf courses. Come on, kids, let's do that. That's how you handle that. And yeah, I agree. Steve in New York points out the smugness is deafening. And look. There were a lot of complaints saying, well, they doctored it. They only put up 2 minutes. Well, it was edited. It was edited because Twitter only lets you put up 2 minutes. The problem is the Sunrise Movement also put up the whole video. It doesn't make Senator Feinstein look any better. If anything, it makes her look worse. And so what you have in this moment is a blown opportunity. You have a blown opportunity on the part of the young organizers on the Sunrise side and on the part of Senator Feinstein as well. You had a chance for a dialogue here in the most rarest of circumstances in which the senator actually comes out and talks to you, and both sides blew it because they were not prepared to dialogue. Each side was prepared to preach. And what a pity that is. Maybe we'll talk about this a little bit more later. But right now, as previously promised, on the line, from the far reaches of New York, is our buddy, Dan Fisher. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
Well, I'm fine. I was just listening for about the past 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, sorry. I just had to wrap.
There's nothing to be sorry about. I'm grateful you had those things to say. And just listening to the passion in your voice, you know, sort of made me wake up a little bit like, oh, yeah, this isn't just about the little, you know, video segment I clicked on and then, oh, isn't that interesting, and clicked off. You're making me look beyond the surface and the memes and to consider the subject matter and the depth of it, and to go beyond just what gets clicks and what gets people mad and yelling at one another. And so thank you for that. I could have sat and listened to another 10 minutes of it. I mean, it almost feels kind of silly that, you know, when am I going to talk about, if I talk about movies or something, how can I follow up that act? Because it's just so.
Oh, I think the reports I've read said, you know, there's plenty to talk about. And some of it touches on the deadly earnest seriousness of what we're moving toward in 2020.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a lot to wrap one's brain around. I mean, there's so many, you know, candidates, at least on the Democratic side. It's so far, it's very hard to really separate any wheat from any chaff, because it's hard to keep up with who's who. And so, again, what you get are these little sort of memeable things like, oh, this one throws temper tantrums against her staff, and this one, you know, we don't like that she was a prosecutor and prosecuted hard, or, you know, or we don't like this about Bernie, or Bernie is God, or, you know, or this person is God. There's no conversation at all. It is talking points. And what's coming up, that's all it's going to be from even the most well-intentioned, you know, people is throwing talking points and yelling and nobody really listening, nobody really conversing.
And see, the thing is, Dan, we haven't even gotten to the point of the long, to the point where the long knives come out, because all of these candidates, even though we have a record number of women running, will eventually get the long knives out.
Well, you have to. I think that Trump's victory a couple of years ago showed that long knives work. It gets people's attention. You cannot be a mere policy wonk anymore. That's out of date.
That's so 20th century.
Exactly.
I can tell you one little factoid that you might find interesting, because I didn't quite get around to this. Every single member of the United States Senate who is running for the presidency of the United States, who's running around and talking about, some of them talking about, oh, I believe in the Green New Deal. And if I'm sounding bitter, I want you to tell me I am, because I'm not trying to. This is just a matter of my experience, okay? Oh. That's all it is. I can tell you that the members of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign have asked every single Democratic member of the Senate of the United States and some Republicans to please, in the name of 900 dead hillbillies a year, introduce a companion bill to the House AIC Act in the Senate. Would you care to guess how many of them, including the Democrats running for Senate, have said, I sure will?
Let me guess, it is a literal round number. Am I right about that?
It's the roundest number of all.
One that approximates a donut, let's say?
Invented by the Mayans.
Mayans invented donuts? They're bigger geniuses than I thought.
God, I love you. No, Mayans invented zero.
I know this. I know.
That's beautiful. But it's the truth.
Yeah. We could just go down, as I like to say, the rabbit hole in so many ways of where we are. I mean, in the whole process it's become pay for play. It's become what gets attention this week might not get attention next week. So I don't really have to make a commitment to the things I say. And the audience isn't asking for it, really. We're asking to be excited. We're asking to be stimulated. We're asking for to be on a winning side. But we're not really holding any particular feet to any particular fire these days. Yeah, one week it's I hate to say the name, but one week it's Jussie Smollett, you know, a couple of weeks ago, it was the kid from Kentucky. And, you know, just a year ago, it was the Parkland kids. And nobody talks about the Parkland kids anymore. And they won't be talking about Jussie Smollett in 2 weeks because something else is going to happen that'll take over that. And we all have become so attention deficit, including myself. I do get the Sunday New York Times every Sunday, but do I read even just the very first section? It takes me all week to read maybe half of the first section, to really read it, you know, to really not just skim the headlines and all, but I'll try to read at least a couple of articles out of every.
And you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but you're a guy who has time to sit around and read, or have until recently.
Had until recently, which we'll get into. Yeah, but I still have. Everybody has time. I mean, it's just a matter of how we use it. And I've gotten better at using it, even now that I'm back to work. But I still don't use it well enough. I still go for the clicks and likes, you know. But some of that too is, look, you know, we're going to get into it with the movie talk, and we will talk Oscars, but it's that line between, am I being too trivial or am I being too serious? Am I going to give myself a heart attack and by trying to take on all of the weight of the world, and will it do any good anyway? You know, or. And do I piss off, you know, do I get into those conversations where I piss off half of my friends because I dare discuss a topic that they disagree with me on, and we spend all day typing our little arguments and counter arguments, and in the end, nothing really changes or gets solved? Or do I just post stuff about movies, and do I just talk about movies and just sort of keep things on the lighter side, like we were once encouraged when we were children to not bring up controversial topics like age or religion or sexual matters or politics, or, you know, even sports sometimes can get you nearly throttled. So I don't know where I'm
going. This is not a year for getting for talking Mountaineer basketball. I can tell you that much.
Oh, is it? I hate to tell you, I don't follow it. I do know that the Knicks are terrible this year, so I don't really follow them much either. I've got too much other stuff to follow than sports teams not doing well, at least. I'll bandwagon with the best of them.
So before we get into things entertainment, everybody wants to know how you're doing.
Well, everybody, thank you. I'm doing very well. I am now back to work. I got the green light for it. And I'm ahead of schedule on that. I had expected to come in early March, back into something, and so what I was going to do for the remainder of February was just work on my physical therapy, go three times a week and walk on the treadmill, and just get back and get ready for March. And then I got a text from a friend who said, I've got something I think you can do, and I'd like you to start very, very soon, 2 days after the text. So I got immediately on the horn, no pun intended, to my cardiologist, who gave me the green light and said, yes, you know, I've said you're ready when you want to be. So, you know, do you want to be? And I was like, yeah, I do. I want to get back to work. I miss being around people. I want to get out of my house a little bit more. And, yeah, I want to make a paycheck on every Thursday. So I'm on a series for Apple TV. Apple is going to be launching, and I don't know if you know this, they're going to be launching their own streaming network. Everybody gets a streaming network now. That's the new thing.
You get a streaming network. You get a streaming network.
Original product. Your Aunt Petulia down in North Carolina, who loves Harlequin romances, trust me, she's developing a series for Netflix. I just know it. We're all going to get our own streaming series soon, because there just isn't enough content to fill up all of those channels. But anyway, Apple TV is entering that, and I did one show for them right before the heart surgery. If you have any newbies, by the way, and I don't know what Bob might have told you in the hour preceding, but I did have a heart transplant September 20th, so we are actually past the fifth month of that. Fifth month anniversary of my having the literal heart of a 25-year-old inserted into my soon-to-be 55-year-old chest. So, yes, this is an Apple TV series. I'm not allowed to talk a whole lot about it, other than it's very ambitious. I think it'll be very, not only entertaining, but very thought-provoking and very timely show called Dream. I think I can at least give the title.
No, say it again. You had a little drop out there.
Oh, it's going to be called Dream, D-R-E-A-M. It is not about Dream Girls. It's not about a Motown-type girl group. It is about people of different nationalities living in the United States of America. I think I could be authorized to say that. It's 8 episodes. It's, again, it's going to be very ambitious. And what I'm doing on it is I'm working with what's called the set dressers in their shop. It's very basic work, but it's a good sort of starting point for me, my return. I'm not going to be on the set for this, which is good because even though I love being on film sets, I love being next to a camera and watching actors and just feeding off that energy. The truth is I don't need to feed off energy right now.
You know, I can see where there might be a little more stress in there than might be good for you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm done prop mastering entirely. That is, I'm done being the boss of my department anymore. Because when you're the boss of a department, it means you can get yelled at for things. You can get fired for things. And I don't want that. I'd rather be just a guy that comes in. And I'm a wheel, or I'm a cog in a many cogged machine, and I do work that has to get done, but doesn't necessarily take on all of that stress and all of that responsibility. You know, everybody has responsibility in any job you ever do, and it's all important. It all adds up to something, and I want to be part of that in any way I can. I think someday I'll get back to being next to a camera. Because I do enjoy that, and it's just fun. It's fun when you see something that just you realize this is working. This is going to be really cool when it comes out on a television set or a movie screen.
Yeah, there's a line from a movie that I can't immediately recall right now, but it's I love it when a plan comes together.
That's not from a movie. That's from The A-Team.
Okay. I had some sort of like Apocalypse Now or something in my head, but maybe because of the letter A.
That was an 80s television show, and I don't know
that poor neuron
at that time, but and I'm not going to speculate too much upon it. But you know, there's you in your head, you confused A-Team with I don't know Lawrence of Arabia or something.
Yeah, but, well, like I said, that poor little lonely neuron.
But yes, I'm doing physically well, and I'm still not out of the woods. I'll never be out of the woods. I'll always be on some form of medication to keep my immune system a bit in check. But every month, every visit I have with the doctor, we keep bringing those meds down a little bit at a time. And sometimes my white blood cell counts go a little low, and that means I have to be a little more careful about being around people and all the germs and diseases they carry around. So I am careful, and I am a good patient.
But while you will always be in the woods, there's a difference between being like Little Red Riding Hood deep in the forest and in the scrub at the edges. We're rooting for the scrub.
Don't I know it? And I'm very grateful for it. I mean, I just spoke recently to two different friends who are recovering from cancer. And then I have a dear uncle on my mother's side who's been going through some issues. He's in his 70s and he slipped and fell on the ice, and some blood entered his skull area and it's affected him. But he's recovering, and that is one great thing about Facebook. Every day I get to see what Uncle Bob is up to, thanks to his wife Nan, and I'm just so I love that I can. Well, it was really hard for a while when he wasn't recovering so well. It's like, oh my God, am I watching something I don't necessarily, you know if I want to see the decline of my beloved Uncle Bob. But he's coming back now, and it's just so wonderful. And you know, he's from Baltimore, and he's always had his feet in Baltimore sports. So I'm sure he's talking about the upcoming Orioles season or what's going on with the Ravens with the draft. And I know what I am, and I know where I am physically. And for as many times as people have said, like, oh, it's such a miracle for you and all of this, and it is, I see somebody like that, or I have another friend who's not much older than me that underwent a stroke and some other symptoms like that. I'm just so lucky, you know. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I just got the good end of the stick on so many things. And granted, there are people that never had any of this kind of stuff that I had to deal with and will go to their graves with the same heart that they came in with.
Well, but glad I am to hear it. And I thought you would like to know that after our previous conversations, I've heard from a number of members of the Horn Family Community Congregation who, mm-hmm. on your recommendation, went and watched Eighth Grade. I'm one of them.
Hooray!
And that was a delightful, delightful little film. I mean, delightful is probably the wrong word. Touching.
It is touching. And I don't know. I mean, there's so much excruciation, you know, for her. There's so many moments where the lead character, Kayla, is just so uncomfortable socially that I don't know if it's necessarily delightful to be in her position.
Yeah, I backed off delightful real fast.
Yeah, I don't mean to attack you for that.
I'll let you know when I feel attacked.
Okay. Don't get butt hurt, you lib. Don't make me own you.
Yeah, don't. Please don't own me, Dan. Don't own me.
Snowflake.
The other thing that grabbed me is, the seventh and eighth grade that I went through was bad enough. It gave, because I have a granddaughter who is approaching Kayla's age in the film. And it, poor baby. What we went through probably would feel like a cakewalk to them. Just because of the inability to get away from it.
I'll tell you one, at least in my high school and my high school years, there's a wonderful difference between what I had to go through when I was in high school, and I know this is, or even junior high, let's say, and what my kids of their generation, and my kids are college age, by the way, to your listeners, what they didn't have to deal with as much is an environment of physical bullying. I was bullied when I was a child, when I was in second grade, and I got bullied quite a bit in high school too, because there was the whole hazing environment at the time that was not discouraged by the faculty or teachers. There was sort of a boys will be boys, it's just part of the tradition sort of mentality to it. It was accepted. And the bullying exists in a different form now. I know this. In some ways it could be more damaging. You know, somebody could post something embarrassing about you that not only everybody in your school finds out, but could go viral, and the next thing you know, it's you doing something that drives you to the point of despair because you're afraid the whole world has seen you naked or the world has seen you drunk and doing something stupid. So there's always torture, I guess. There's always, and at least eighth grade, you know, it's a movie and it's a comedy, but it's my favorite kind of comedy, which is it's comedy that's based in realism and has those moments that are not funny at all, that are harrowing or that you can so identify with that you might be just cringing as you watch it, but it's real and happened. Certainly there's moments that happened to me that are very similar to Kayla, and even the most popular kid in the school, there's always some point or other you do something stupid in front of your friends or you just feel like you don't belong. You know, and I think that eighth grade.
Well, I love the father's monologue toward the end of the film.
Oh my God! You know what? That's really, that monologue was what made me say yes to the movie, to doing that movie, because it wasn't a big fat paycheck. It was a very low budget movie, which meant that everybody on the crew, including myself, would be paid less to do it. And I read the script, and I was really liking it. And then I read that monologue. And for anybody who hasn't seen Eighth Grade yet, and it is on Prime, Amazon Prime Video for free, If you have Amazon Prime, you can watch it. The father has this monologue that all throughout the movie, the father and the daughter, who's graduates from eighth grade, she's going to be going into high school, which I think makes her 13 or 14. But all throughout the movie, they're having problems communicating because she just really doesn't want to have a whole, she doesn't have a whole lot to say to her dad, and she really doesn't want to listen to a whole, there's that awkward pause. And I say identifying with Kayla, but I also very much identified with the father, because I've had that with my own kids, where sometimes I just don't know what the hell to say to them. You know, you can only ask how school so many times. So in the movie, toward the end, and I don't want to spoil too much, but Kayla and her father have not been communicating well. And something really bad happens to her. And at one point she asks him, what does she say? Oh, are you disappointed in me? You know, are you, it's been a while since I've watched it or since I've read the script. But basically she asks her father, are you disappointed in me? Do you wish you hadn't had me? And the father has this monologue that goes on for like 3 or 4 minutes on the page. It takes a page and a half of script, which is a lot of dialogue. And he just says, no. He says, every time I see you, I'm so thankful. You have no idea what you bring to me, how happy you make me.
I heard that monologue and I was like, I wish this movie had existed a few years ago, because I could have used that script.
Yeah, well, you have to find the right time for that. God, you ask my kids, God knows I give a lot of monologues. I've given them monologues my whole life because I like to talk. Hence, I'll do these 2-hour, 3-hour
monologues. Yeah, I'm totally out of touch with that idea. So,
yeah. My kids used to nickname me Mike Brady from the Brady Bunch, because I kept trying to insert these little moralistic things into every moment of their lives. Like, you know, this is why you always pour the milk, you know, on the cereal afterwards. There's some I'd always try to find little meanings in these things. And my kids would just turn to me and just say, Dad, Mike Brady. They wouldn't even say, don't be Mike Brady. They'd say, Mike Brady, Dad, which meant we get it. We understand. You can stop the sentences now.
Yeah. Whereas mine often took the form of, okay, who put the empty milk jug back in the fridge?
Right.
Let's do this again.
That's stretching for, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a beautiful thing that he says, and it's just at the moment she needs to hear it. It's just there. And I think there is that.
It's kind of a salvation moment.
I've had those moments. I've had them in my 50s where, whether you go to your parents or your wife or your best friend or your preacher or whoever, where you just say, you know what? I'm throwing myself at your mercy. I need your help. I don't know. I'm so lost right now. I don't know what to do. And to have somebody and just say, I just think you're the best. I think you're great. Don't be so hard on yourself. That's a movie we need. We need messages like that. We need scenes like that to inspire us. And even if you see the movie and you don't like the movie for whatever reason, there are people that didn't love it in eighth grade. But overall people did. It's won a lot of awards, but if nothing else, I think that scene is just gangbusters. And I
did want to ask you about one little trivia point, and I'm guessing it's okay for you to go into this, because you mentioned, you know, it's a comedy of sorts, but one of the biggest laughs I got out of it actually had to do with the props in the film.
Yeah. Which one or which?
Well, the effect of the scene with the broken phone screen.
Uh-huh.
I read somewhere that Apple was on board to provide all the computers.
Well, you know, what's typical when you do a movie or a TV show where, I mean, pretty much any movie or TV show that takes place within the past 5 years, one of the major props of anything like that is going to be a laptop and a character's cell phone, if not a whole bunch of them. So it's just become standard, and I've done it all the time, to call up a product placement representative. There are people that's all they do all day long is decide whether or not to send out models of laptops to movie companies or TV shows, and how many, and then what to do with them at the end and so forth, and also sort of monitor how much placement they actually get. Now, yeah, so the thing is that there is a scene in eighth grade where Kayla, the young girl, accidentally breaks her cell phone. And I knew right out, I've dealt enough with Apple that I knew this could be problematic. But I did reach out to the product placement representative, and she said the magic words, send us a script. And I sent it, and I knew what the answer would be. She said, we can send you pretty much everything you want, but you have to get rid of the scene where the screen cracks, because we don't want it. Everybody knows that Apple screens occasionally crack, but we don't want to see that in a movie. We want people to have the impression that it takes a hell of a lot for an Apple's screen to crack, which is fair. Listen, I'm not knocking Apple at all. They spend a lot of money to develop their products, and they spend a lot more to promote their products. And they have an image of what they want their product to look like. They put the time and the money into that. So it's not up to me to say, well, I don't care what you think. I'm going to show this whatever, and by the way, give me free products. I mean, at the very least, I can depict the product not being what they want it to be, but I should at least have the courtesy not to ask them for free stuff if I'm going to go against their wishes. So anyway, I went to Bo and I said, we can get all the computers and phones, but they want us to lose that scene. And Bo was adamant, no, I don't want to lose that scene. And I have to say something, too, about my judgment and the judgment of our director, Bo Burnham. I really thought that the phone crack wasn't necessary. I was like, is this really worth? I mean, it's a moment, and what does that really matter? There's plenty of other laughs, and there's plenty of other moments. Can we lose that because we're so tight with money? It's like we could save so much money if we just dropped the one paragraph in that scene, or, you know, the scene was not very long anyway. If we just dropped that little bit, we can save a lot of money for this movie. But Bo held firm, and he said, no, I want to do this way.
And you know what? I can understand that choice.
Oh, sure.
Because
the movie, I totally get it.
Because it adds to her angst.
Absolutely. And throughout the rest of the movie, every time you look down at the phone, you see these cracks. And it just has a whole different effect than every time you look at the phone, you see graphics. So what we wound up doing, what I wound up doing, was two things. For the phones, I went to the nearest, I went to my local mall, and I bought I'm lying to you. I went online, I went to eBay, and I found two iPhones unlocked, ready to go, that I bought for as cheap as I could get them. And I got them 2 or 3 days later. Then I went to my mall and I had the phone. I put SIM cards in them that activated the phones, that gave them working lines. And I had two phones. It's all I had for the whole movie. And there's lots of characters in that movie that have phones. So then what I did is I bought a bunch of phone cases of different colors and patterns and styles. So throughout the movie, you're seeing the same phone. It's just a different phone case. And a phone is a phone is a phone, especially if you've got a different case on. And I knew that of those two, one of them had to be the cracked phone. But we were going to save the cracked, we absolutely had to do it. And when it came time to do it, Bob, I chickened out. I was a
That was the next question.
Big fat baby on this one. I was a coward. I just couldn't do it. I was so afraid. I've got one chance for this major prop in the film. And if I screw it up, I don't know what I'm going to do. We just don't have the money to keep buying iPhones. So I handed it over to my boss, the designer, Sam Lysenko, and he did it. Just did it. Just didn't even think about it. Didn't crap. And he did it perfectly. First shot out, he did it perfectly.
How'd he do it? I mean,
he just hit it against like a step on the living room stairs. It was just very casual and just here. This is what would happen. Pat, done. Here's your prop. He didn't say you big fat baby, but I wouldn't have blamed him. Here's your prop, you big fat baby. So I take the thing. And the one thing I did do too was that there's these things you can buy for your screen. You might have one. And they're plastic covers with adhesive on one side.
Yeah, or glass, see? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, or glass. That's right, yeah. And you cover it. And I did that so it would keep the shards in place so that they wouldn't get jostled and start to fall out or whatever. So it kept everything in one place. I did have some screens, some replacement screens too. I actually had thought ahead, but I did chicken out. But anyway,
you know, that's a great, that would be a great scene in a script by itself. You know, boss, I can't do it. I can't break the phone.
Can't do it. And then her laptop in the movie is the very same one that I'm speaking with right now, to you with right now. That is, I just brought in my own computer, and that became Kayla's, and it became a couple other people's as well. Again, you'll notice Kayla has one of those shells on her laptop, a purple shell.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I did. When it was Kayla's time, we stuck the purple shell on, and it was somebody else's. We stuck, I think, a black one on, or took it off altogether, and it was just, you know, I think we used my one computer all throughout the movie, and we stick it in the background.
You know, that's just a beautiful, beautiful little tale of you know, of what magicians never do, tell you how the trick works.
Yep, it's exactly like a really cheap birthday magician. It's all about, hey, kids, look at my right hand while the left hand is grabbing the dove and sticking it in the hat or something. And I also need to give credit to one other person, which is our production manager slash one of the producers on Eighth Grade, because a lot of times I work on productions, both big and small, where they are so afraid of getting sued. They're so afraid that Apple is going to, you know, sue you for $1 billion, and they're Apple. So it's like, oh, we better not. But, you know, I said to him, you know, Bo wants to do the scene. You know, do we need to Greek it up? You know, it always looks stupid when you Greek out the Apple logo, you stick a piece of tape on it or something like that. And plus, everybody knows what an Apple, and we're going to use, and we used real interfaces. Every time you see Kayla on the phone, or not every time, but a lot of times you see Kayla on the phone or she's texting. That's not CGI graphics. I just put in real phone service and text services, and all the stuff on her laptop, go into Facebook. We made up a fake Facebook page for Kayla. We didn't have the money for a graphic designer to do this. And we did it all, you know, it's like, that's really Facebook. We didn't call it like Spacebook or MeBook. No, we just did the real thing. And the producers were like, you know what? People use Facebook, and people do break their phone screens. So let them sue us, because, well, first of all, they won't. We don't believe they're going to sue us. And what are they going to say? Apple screens never break? We all know they do. So, and Apple did never sue us. And I'm sure actually in the long run, they were grateful to see their product in this particular movie, or they should be, because it's a target audience for them. It's kids who stare at their phones all day and who stare at their laptops all day. It's not secret CIA spies or...
And it's real life.
It's real life. And you can watch Eighth Grade on your phone with a cracked screen or not. It's your choice. So that's one of the sleight of hands, I guess, I did on it. I love doing that movie. Bo Burnham, God bless him. I've worked on a lot of movies with first-time directors. And so often they're so afraid of the crew taking over the movie from them that they won't listen to the crew at all. They won't listen to the director of photography. They have to have their hands in it. Bo always listened. And his philosophy, and it's the same one that I had with the Americans, his philosophy was best idea wins. And folks, I like to do the Bob Kincaid thing of folks. Whatever you do for work, if you're in an office or if you're working with a team of people, I can't encourage it enough. And it took me so many years to really learn it and really apply it. Is just best idea wins. Don't let go of your ego. You don't have to always be the one that's right, and you don't have to be the one that comes up with the solution that saves everybody's necks. If it's a great idea, use it and try to give credit for it. But the end result should be what it's about. And it's certainly something that Bo knew instinctively, to just listen to other people. This was his first movie, whereas in my case, that was probably something like my 51st or 61st movie. I don't know how many credits.
And, you
I
know,
have.
Oddly enough, there's a little bit of overlap with the politics that we do here.
Yeah.
Because there is at least one campaign that is getting a lot of coverage for the exact opposite of everything you just said.
Which campaign are you referring to?
Well, Amy Klobuchar's campaign.
Oh, see, all I've followed so far of Klobuchar are the little headlines about what a supposed bitch she is.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. You know, the remark where they're walking through the Capitol and it's hot, and she looks at three of her aides and said, "I'd sell all three of you for a bottle of water."
Mm-hmm.
Or the sort of petty Martinet stuff, where it sounds like she's afraid to let down her grasp on power for fear that, you know, the crew will mutiny or something.
Right.
You
right.
Know, the Captain Bly approach.
I'm going to utilize and I can be, if somebody wants to burn me for it, that's fine. I'll take my licks. I'm going to use my white man's privilege for a minute to just say that I have heard at times rude and unprofessional behavior from women excused by, well, if a man did it, it'd be okay. And you know what I say? I say it's never okay. I don't care who it is. You should not professionally be excused for treating people like shit. I don't care who you are. Have I taken shit by my superiors and taken it with a smile on my face? Yes, I have. But that doesn't mean I say, well, it's great that, let's say, Darren Aronofsky did it to me, but God forbid that one of the women directors I've worked with does it. No, to me, rudeness is rudeness, and human behavior should try to meet a standard. Have I been an asshole to people working with me or, let's say, under me? I'm sure I have. I'm sure I've been snotty. You know, I'm sure I've had bad days where I've said something.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. Where is the justification for throwing a binder at somebody?
There is no justification. You're treating somebody as lesser than you. You're treating them as lesser than human. And I don't care who you are. I don't care who the supposed victim is. There's no cause for that. I get embarrassed when I see people treating waiters like crap. They're not slaves and they work very, very hard. I've had plenty of terrible waiters and there's ways you can at least say, I asked for my steak medium rare and this is burnt or crisp, please take it back. You can do that in a way you can get what you want, which is the steak the way you want it, without castigating somebody, without being abusive. You know, to be nice, to be pleasant, to be civil does not mean you're a pussy. It doesn't mean you give up everything. You give up, you just let people walk all over you. No, there's a way to be firm and polite. It doesn't seem because I'm not there, I don't know it. And of all people, I'm very aware of the lines between public perception and what actually happened. But I don't know the specifics or the truth of Klobuchar, and I don't know what she stands for. There's so many, like I said, there's so many candidates right now. I haven't yet looked at all.
Well, I wouldn't beat myself up over that, Dan, because the tack I'm taking and what I've been encouraging, because here I'm not allowed to tell anybody what to do or anything, because mm-hmm. if I say, you know, try that new just add an egg thing that's in the egg aisle in the grocery store because it's quick and easy and it's not bad, I will immediately get an email back saying, stop telling people how to eat their eggs, Bob.
Right.
And so I try not to do that. But great God almighty, it is February 2019. The first primary is a year away. And we don't know who's going to be in the contest. We don't know. We don't know how long any of them will last.
Nope.
And if you jump out there, and go all in for one or another,
then that increases the likelihood that we do 2016 again.
Uh-huh.
And if there's...
I see your point.
From where I stand, the one thing on this sweet little blue-green time machine marble hurtling through the universe that we cannot afford to do is have 2016 again.
No, God, no.
Only, please. You know, only with a dozen fractures instead of just one.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that the same bad actors who were bad acting in 2016 are probably bad acting again and trying to exploit. And the thing is, these are weaknesses, and they are weaknesses that they are trying to exploit.
Can we get back to fun stuff?
Let's go back to the movies.
Hey. You know what there was last night? I don't know if you saw, there was this little stupid, cheesy award show.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, see, it took no time at all. Jack in Shreveport just wrote in and said, stop telling us what month it is, Bob. Yeah, so.
You think that was tongue-in-cheek?
Yeah. I'm sorry?
I guess that I can only hope that was tongue-in-cheek.
Oh, it is. It, there's one of those a night.
Oh, good.
It all started back in 2016 when I was telling not telling people who to vote for, and I, you know, the sparkle fart powered unicorn cavalry purity brigade inundated me with stuff telling us who to vote for, Bob. You know, even though I wasn't telling anybody who to vote for, except for don't vote for Trump.
Well, I'm on my old pal Facebook. I'm almost just ready to give up on applying sarcasm to anything because people don't. There's no emojicon to show that you mean to be sarcastic. I mean, I guess you can put one of those smiley faces or the ones that throw up or a piece of poop or something. But
I use the one with the emoji that's winking and sticking its tongue out.
Okay, maybe that works. I've yet to find something that really transmits the idea of I'm being sarcastic, folks, that plays on the Facebook page. It just every time I try, I get slammed by somebody. So,
well, there's a lot of people out in the world who apparently really, really, really need to be angry.
Yep.
I'm not that guy. I might have been that guy once upon a time. I am not that guy anymore.
Yeah. In fact, there's an Elvis Costello song about that. I'm not angry anymore. I don't remember anything other than the chorus, which is I'm not angry anymore.
Oh, he did. He does have a way with words, doesn't he? No, I love Elvis.
Oh, yeah. And he is actually a fantastic lyricist. But yeah, the Oscars were last night. Did you watch them?
I checked in periodically, but for the most part, I admit that I watched clips.
Clips of the, oh, you mean the next day?
Yeah.
That's how I watch Saturday Night Live anymore. But I have to watch the Oscars, you understand? This is like Christmas, and thank God I married a woman who is into it every bit as much as I am. It's Christmas in our house. To skip it would be like on the 25th, just waking up and going out to a house of pancakes and then coming home and watching TV with no presents, no tree. This household needs the Oscars. We get up for it, you know, We're literally up the morning.
Now, are you that way for the Emmys and the Grammys and the rest of them too?
Emmys, the past couple of years, I've been a bit because of the Americans. The show that I've worked on has been awarded a lot of stuff.
And you've got a piece of a Grammy now. I mean, an Emmy. Sorry.
No, well, that speech was actually not during the Emmys. It was during another one of the award shows. Was it the Critics' Choice or was it the Producers Guild? We've had a very good year for the Americans, winning in its final season Best Drama. I think some of that was because Game of Thrones had not released their season in time to be under consideration, so we didn't have to compete with them. But what Bob is alluding to is on one of the awards shows, the producers got up for about the fifth time in 6 weeks to accept an award for Best Show, and they mentioned in their thank you speech, they thanked every crew head, every department head in the crew. They thanked the gaffer, J.P. Dolan. They thanked Gary Martone, Nikki Grip. They mentioned all these different departments. And one of them, God bless them, thanked me, Dan Fisher. He said, I'd like to thank Dan Fisher. He literally gave his heart to this production. And, oh, my God, I'm going to cry right now just quoting it. That's incredible. That's one off of my bucket list to be mentioned during an awards show. But that's those guys. That's that crew, that's those producers. We call them the Jays. I'm going to blank on their names because I'm about to cry. But anyway, the producers for that show, they're just the best. And nobody, I think what they did was unprecedented. I don't think I've ever heard in an awards show, any awards show, when you win best whatever, that they go up and they start naming the crew by name. That doesn't happen. I mean, not just about me and mentioning my heart or making that nice little allusion to give your heart, but even just my friends Gary and JP and the costume designer and the hair and makeup and locations and all on and on and on. Nobody does that, but they did it. Because that's who they are, and I can't imagine being in their shoes. You're under the time pressure. You've got 30 seconds and to do this. I guess in a way it's easier that they had already won a bunch of times, thankfully, and they should have. It's a fantastic show, but by that point they didn't have to thank their wife for the sixth time in a row. They had the time to mention the crew, and I'm very honored and very just flabbergasted by the whole thing to this day, and to have it on video that my mom could see and my friends that I grew in West Virginia see that. There is an ownership stake no matter what you do when you work on something. And again, I'm not just talking movies and TV. Anything where you're with a bunch of people and you create something, and then that something gets noticed or makes a lot of profit for everybody, hopefully, there's just that ownership stake feeling that you contributed, that it wouldn't have been the same end product without you.
Even this little program, Dan, even this little program where there's no profits being made. Still, because of things I learned in a former life, the program ends every night with a list of spoken credits and thanks, because it would not be the same program without the people who get mentioned. It might not even be a program at all.
You were raised right, I'm sure of that.
I was taught well by people in various and sundry departments.
Sure.
Not just theater, but law and journalism and. Just about every discipline that I studied, and I tried to study everything but math. They all had the same message, a lot of it boils down to the epigram from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Dudes, be excellent to each other, and if you do that, you will often find that things go smashingly, and that it provides its own reward.
I agree. At the end of the day, that's what matters. I mean, it's good that you can put food on the table and you can pay the rent, but it's also wonderful if whatever you do for work provides just that level of satisfaction. And I've been very lucky myself to feel a level of satisfaction more often than not.
Well, it's like that photograph that I posted over the weekend that you saw.
Yeah. Yeah, the guy that looks like John McCain.
The guy that looks like John McCain is my dad.
Yes.
And he was a furnace operator. And it took a long time for me to understand. I thought he was being a smartass for a long time. But he wasn't. He would say, "Goody, I get to go to work today."
Mm.
Because he loved what he did. And when I got old enough, probably about the same age as in that photograph, he said, "Listen, if you like what you do and someone is willing to pay you to do it, you win."
Hmm.
And the irony of that is that within 2 years of that photograph, the company that he loved to work for screwed him. He developed angina, and they told him, "Hey, listen, why don't you quit your job here? I mean, never mind your pension. We'll just cancel that out. Why don't you just quit your job here and get a low stress job, say working at a gas station?"
This is, I swear to God, this is very, very similar, including the gas station punchline, very similar to what happened to my grandfather on my mother's side. He was at J&L Steel in Pittsburgh for a lot of years, and he got similarly screwed. But please go on. My eyes, you can't see them, but my eyes are like, they're open wide, because you're in many ways you're telling the story of my grandfather.
Well, unfortunately,
and a lot of grandfathers were screwed by their company.
And unfortunately, well, as it turns out, over the course of the weekend, I've had conversations online and offline with a number of people who say, "Yeah, the same thing that company did to your dad, they did to my uncle, they did to my dad, they did to my grandfather," and what we're seeing there is, I think, an early indicator of the transformation of the American dream.
Whoa.
We're seeing it's kind of like, I don't know, you're in your 30s and you notice that, you know, you get a dry mouth a lot, and 10 years later somebody says, "Oh, well, that was because you were getting diabetic. Pity we didn't get on it soon enough."
Mm.
And that willingness to cast people aside in the late 70s, moving into the early 80s, that was supposed to be abnormal then, Dan.
Yeah,
and it's the normal now.
We've been taught now to expect less. And you and I think, growing up when we did, I was 6 years old in 1970. And I think that was the tail end of that baby boom post-World War II optimism that the world is your oyster. I mean, granted, we were white kids. Maybe we had been told to have higher expectations, but we were boys. But nonetheless, there was an optimism that still carried forth into my childhood of hearing and believing that you can have the house and the car, and you can go on a vacation once a year, and all of this is affordable to you. And it's not that people don't go on vacations or don't have cars, but now it's like, well, you know, you're going to rack up a lot of debt first, you know, just going to college. So when you come out of college and you have a lot of debt, you're going to start a job at this amount of money an hour, which sounds like more money than it did in 1970, but the truth is,
it's less.
So much, yeah. It's prices have raised so much that no way that what you're making per hour catches up with the increase in prices of everything, including the house that you want to buy and including the car that you have your eye on. So expect less.
We have to understand things like that within a temporal context. In 1976. Ronald Reagan very nearly prevented Gerald Ford from being the presidential nominee of the GOP.
Uh-huh. I remember that.
And he never stopped campaigning from 1976 to 1980.
Uh-huh.
And the things they were campaigning on was the evils of being a member of a union. It's also the same time that you see the rise of what I now refer to as the religion industry.
Uh-huh.
Who curiously were preaching the same message. You know, very few people remember that Billy Graham got his start with funding from American corporations who more or less paid him to say that unions were communist and Jesus didn't love them.
Although what's funny, I don't know where it is, and I don't want to get distracted. I found this really great quote that I'll send you sometime. From Billy Graham in 1981, I was researching for this novel I'm writing, and I found a quote from Billy Graham that says something to the effect of, believe it or not, it says, religion should. I'm paraphrasing intensely, but he was on the side of religion staying the hell out of American politics.
Well, that was the stated policy of the Southern Baptist Convention back then, Dan.
Yes, that's right.
It was we'll take care of your soul. The government will take care of government. And as long as the government doesn't mess with us, we won't mess with the government. And that all goes out the window with an ambitious, vicious ideologue by the name of Jerry Falwell.
Yep.
I mean, I'm old enough to... Wow. We're going to talk about the Oscars yet. I swear, Dan.
Yeah,
I promise.
Sing up. But before you folks up, stick your heads in ovens. We'll get back to fun things.
I do want to share one email with you before we get back to fun things.
Okay.
It comes from Darlene in Connecticut, and she says maybe it's because
before when I've been on, I may be wrong, but that sounds familiar.
Yeah, Darlene is a longtime member of the community, and it's one of the beauties of this program is I get all this input that changes the way I think about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody in this little family community congregation is constantly thinking, constantly analyzing, constantly processing, so that we can all sort of keep ourselves away from having to stare into the abyss and have the abyss stare back.
On fire tonight, Robert.
Well, thank you. Dare I say that I'm beyond? Might we say that I'm beyond? I'm past. I'm more than adequate this evening. Dear God, what will happen?
That new definition for what adequate could be.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah,
changed the standard. You've moved the goalposts of adequacy.
Wow. I got to get a Wikipedia page.
Hey, you ain't the only one that can say a couple of words here and there.
Well, you have no doubt about it. But Darlene says...
What about Darlene in Connecticut?
Yes.
Are you still there, Darlene, or did you just give up on it?
No, she's still there.
Just read my email.
Read the goddamn email. Right. Maybe it's because I'm experiencing White House staff turnover fatigue with the current administration, but my feelings about Amy Klobuchar's behavior towards her staff have evolved from disappointment to abhorrence. The reports detailing her behavior are downright disturbing. She's not disputing these accusations, but I think she'll need to address them at some future point in time, as she'll continue to be dogged by them. Based on what I recently read, she sounds downright certifiable. The argument that she's a victim of sexism is falling flat with me at this stage. And this is the important part. I agree with Dan.
Hooray. That's all that really counts, as long as I'm agreed with. We don't need another asshole for president. For whatever the political leanings, I'm anti-asshole. And here's an example I thought of recently in terms of the whole, let's come up with another way to try to penetrate the thick skulls of Trump worshippers, which was, I said, okay, imagine this scenario. You're in a bar with a couple of friends. A guy comes into the bar, and he happens to stand next to you at the bar. You strike up a conversation with this stranger. During the conversation, that stranger talks about how he's the best at everything. He proceeds to denigrate people he does not like by calling them low IQ and little. What else were some of the things? But anyway, the punchline was, after putting up with this asshole for the entire night, he leaves and you realize that he didn't pay for his own drinks. You've been buying him drinks the whole time, and never once did he spring for one. That's basically it. We have President Asshole. And you could say what you want about George W. Bush. You could hate the politics and policies of Barack Obama, but they weren't complete assholes. I'm not saying that George W. Bush is the model for human wonderfulness. And it's always like, well, compared to Trump, but compared to Trump, he's okay, you know, and Obama was certainly so civil, you know. Again, you could have a different opinion than me about the ACA or what it did to you in your particular circumstances, but he wasn't a jerk. This guy is a jerk. This guy is if you were sitting next to him, after a while you couldn't want to you would want to get out of the room from being, you wouldn't want to be stuck with this guy next to you in the bar, in the metaphorical bar I created, or anywhere else. He's a jerk. And it's like, well, we need a jerk. We need a strong jerk to show all the other jerks in the world that we're the biggest jerks and we can rule all the other. No. We don't need to be jerks to be leaders. We don't need to be jerks to be successful. We can be successful and be humane. It doesn't make you weak to say, I'm sorry. It doesn't make you weak to have compassion for other people or sympathy. It makes you strong, because it takes a hell of a lot of guts to say, I'm sorry, or I was wrong. Think of how hard it is when you've had to say it. You have to summon your strength to swallow so much pride. And if you're that strong, you'll do it. And we have a president that is incapable of such strength. He is very, very weak, because he cannot say he's wrong. He cannot say he's sorry. And we have so many people, and not just Republicans and not just MAGAs. I've seen good, well-meaning liberals, and it's what you were referring to earlier, who are incapable of saying they're wrong, who are incapable of seeing one piece of physical evidence when it's put right in front of their face to say, you know what, on this account, you're right. I see the video footage and I misjudged it, or I jumped to a conclusion too soon.
Exactly.
We don't do that anymore. Did we ever? I hope we did once. But we certainly now it's with, again, I don't mean to be get off my lawn and all that regarding social media, because I'm a social media junkie. But it just gets so tiring and so boring to see constantly people wanting to win, wanting to own each other. Just listen to one another. And if you're wrong, say you're sorry. Admit you're an asshole. I'm an asshole sometimes. I'll tell you something, and this gets back to the Oscar thing. I think I might have been an asshole today regarding the Oscars. Because on one of my friend's Facebook posts, he posts about Green Day. Green Book.
Green Book.
I adore Green Day. I love American Idiot. It's a great album. But Green Book is a movie I've not yet seen. I will say that again. I have not seen Green Book. Does that mean I have no opinion about Green Book? Of course not. I've got plenty of opinions about something that I don't really know that much about.
Seen it, shmeen it. I've got an opinion.
Because sometimes I am an asshole. Well, okay, let's not flog myself too much yet. But let me put it this way. Why? It's been out long enough. It's been out at least probably 2 months, right? Why did I not flock to see Green Book? I'm sure I'll see it. Did you see it, Bob?
No.
Have you seen it?
No. For the most part, like I said, I'm a when it comes out streaming, I'll be able to watch it.
Okay. But this is the thing. I have friends who I consider have good taste saw it, said, I liked it a lot. I think it's a terrific movie. Some people even went as far as to say it is the best movie of the year. My reason for not going to see it is I'm tired of these movies that show the black experience, but you got to have a white guy either to see it through the eyes of, or at the very least, it's a buddy movie. And it's still really about the white guy. I mean, who was nominated for the lead in Green Book? It wasn't the black guy. It was the white guy.
It was about the, yeah, right, exactly.
How the black guy changed him. Right? And I haven't seen it. Okay. So I can have an opinion, sure. And I'm expressing it right now. And for all I know, there's somebody furiously typing away their emails. And bring it on, folks. Hit me square in the skull.
I don't think this is the community that's gonna do that.
Okay. But,
the way Spike Lee responded to it, because remember, he was up for Best Picture for Do the Right Thing when Driving Miss Daisy won.
1989, one of the biggest travesties of Oscar. I know my Oscar history. I know it.
And
better.
So he tweeted something or said something like, every time a black guy goes driving, I lose. They just changed the seating arrangements this time.
That's pretty much it. And it isn't just about this one movie. I wouldn't be surprised if I finally see Green Day streaming on my television and I say, you know what? This is actually pretty good. I'm enjoying this movie. whether or not it's against my will, I'm liking this thing. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
But okay, here's one for you. I mean, because the gowns and the speeches and the crowd, the crowd shots, it's all fun and fascinating.
Yeah.
But some of the stuff that happens around it is mind-blowing, too. I found it kind of weird. No, I found it a lot weird. I found it weird and terrifying, actually. Weird and terrifying. That with regard to the Oscars that that Black Panther won.
Uh-huh.
We haven't thrown around nearly as many vulgar words in this conversation as I usually do, but I got one here. The fucking CIA tweets about Black Panther?
But it was weird. It was like, what do you think we could do with vibranium? I saw that one. They were all about, like, could we use it to make magic flying cars or something? It's like, you're the CIA. What? Exactly right. It's like, did everybody go home early? And was it take your teenage daughter to work day at the CIA? Did little Missy from seventh grade decide to get on and start typing about vibranium or something?
I mean, it's the CIA. I wonder if they know that there's something very similar to vibranium, and they're getting ready to plot a goddamn coup in that country. It's the CIA. Is Venezuela actually the home of vibranium?
Trump, I wouldn't be surprised if Trump puts out in his tweet tomorrow that he's going to declare war on Wakanda. You watch. Everybody made fun of him at the Oscars last night, so he's gonna drop the bomb on Wakanda. And nobody has the heart to tell him that it doesn't exist.
Yeah, they won't be laughing then. No, they won't be laughing. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll show them. My bad Trump, but never mind.
I know. At least you acknowledge the bad Trump. I was giving a respectful silence as I contemplated, do I go for an Alan Baldwin joke here, or what
that's,
do I do?
Yeah, but that's why I love you.
I love you too. Hey, by the way, I did find that Billy Graham quote. You want to hear it?
Yeah. What?
This was from February 1981 in, of all places, Parade magazine. You remember that?
Oh, of course.
The
My Weekly Reader for grown-ups in the Sunday paper.
What's the Sunday paper without Parade magazine? You might as well not have Family Circus.
Well, but that's a different discussion.
That's another rabbit hole. Here's the quote. It would disturb me if there was a wedding between the religious fundamentalists and the political right. The hard right has no interest in religion except to manipulate it. Billy Graham, Parade Magazine, February 1981.
I want that on a T-shirt, complete with Billy Graham's face.
I will. I'll copy and paste it and send it to you on your IM. Because it's definitely worth it. Let me get back to Green Book.
Yes, please.
Before I forget that I discussed it in the first place. So, yeah, I was being an asshole, okay? Let's just say I was proffering something of a strong and potentially controversial opinion, which is saying I'm getting really, really tired of white savior movies, that I have no problem seeing a movie about racism that would be shown with black people experiencing it by themselves and dealing with it on their own and reacting on their own. And also, I'm getting tired of all of these racism is bad movies taking place all in the 1960s and most of them in the American South. And the big bad guys are always like the big dumb hick with the beard and the big belly and blah, 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 or the Ku Klux Klan. It just makes it all too
easy.
It's easy. You get to watch that on the screen. You can go, well, I got my flaws and I got my problems, but I'm not that guy. And I know this sounds like I'm stealing from there's a really good Seth Meyers video that's making the rounds that satirizes the white savior thing that came out just before the Oscars the other night. But I swear these are original ideas that Seth Meyers probably copied off of me. It isn't just about it offending me and my snowflake liberal butthurt feelings. it's as a moviegoer, I'm tired of seeing that same movie over and over. Driving Miss Daisy was 1989. That's what? That's almost 30 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And we're still getting essentially, okay, I've not seen Green Book. I could be totally wrong. But
you have to take the family's statement somewhat to heart.
Well, yes and no, because there is, listen, my family has probably said things about me that are not entirely accurate. And
but when they say we were not in the least consulted in this.
Well, supposedly there are recordings of the main of the guy played by Maharishi, and I know that's not right. It's disrespectful.
Mahashar Ali.
Yeah. Supposedly that character is on tape talking about how close he was to the Viggo Mortensen character. And there's something else when I was doing a little research today about this. Because, again, I was like, well, what do black people think about Green Book? Do they love it the way a lot of my white liberal friends love it? And I was researching around, and I saw, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar had, really great things to say about the movie. And so did Quincy Jones, and they're black. And, Kareem is known for his political leanings. So I give some credence to that. It's like, okay. And listen, the most phony baloney movie of the year when it comes to turning fact into complete fiction is Bohemian Rhapsody. I mean, it's an entertaining movie. Did you see that? Did you see that one?
Actually, we've got that here, and I'm going to see it. Probably before I see anything else.
Entertaining as hell. It's a big piece of entertaining cheese. And if you grew up around the time we did, it's fun because you get to hear the songs that we all grew up with, and we get to see. And Rami's great, doing his Freddie Mercury and all of that. But I noticed right away that this was not going to be a factually accurate movie, because I'm seeing one scene that supposedly takes place in 1973, and I know enough about Queen. I'm like, that song they're playing didn't come out until the Jazz album, which I think was 77 or 78. And that other song that they're playing as if it's brand new, that one actually came out on their third album. So there's a lot of they really Hollywood the hell out of that movie. It's entertaining.
But that's that. That you just sort of entered into another aspect of the discussion, Dan, whether you meant to or not, and that is the predilection for giving Best Actor Academy Awards or Best Actress Academy Awards to anybody who gets made over into looking like someone else,
a famous person. Yeah,
I mean the same thing.
Winston Churchill,
precisely, or Gandhi.
Yeah. Yep.
It is as though, I mean, if you think about and I know you read it, if you go back to Stanislavski's An Actor Prepares.
Yes, I have read that one. It's true.
There's a passage where the teacher talks about that form of acting where the actor relies on appliances. And it seems
like beards and glasses, not refrigerators and microwaves.
Right. Precisely. Yes. Lest there be any confusion.
That which can be applied.
Yeah.
The body or physiognomy therefore.
And he says it can be a very satisfying theatrical experience, but you're not likely to see people exploring the depths of humanity in that kind of a portrayal.
Yes and no. I think there were depths of humanity in Rami's portrayal of Freddy.
I mean, whether it's what he did in Mr. Robot or whether it's what he did in the South Pacific, which he got a lot less notice for that. But Jesus Christ,
I know
what you're talking.
Yes, I know that movie.
He's obviously a fantastic actor. So I couldn't be happier for him. And the business with his bow tie was positively adorable.
I don't know to which you were referring.
Well, there were everybody and their cousin came up to Rami Malek and tried to square up his bow tie on his tux.
Oh, uh-huh.
I mean, Gaga tried to square up his bow tie. His brother tried to square up his bow tie. And by the time he's standing up there with the statuette in his hand, his bow tie is still askew. And the entire social media world said, well, it seems pretty obvious that Freddie did not want that bow tie to be straight.
Okay. Can I get back to me being an asshole for a second?
You know, this is the program where you can be all the asshole you want to be.
Well, I don't want to be one right now, but I suspect I was kind of one today, and I feel really bad about it, which is that a friend of mine had posted on Facebook something to the effect of, you know, I'm really happy that the Green Book won Best Picture. And I had to get in there, and I had to say, look, I haven't seen it, but I'm just tired of seeing the black experience as seen through the eyes of white people in 1960s, the American South, you know, like 10,000 other movies out there that tell you the big, deep meaning that racism is bad.
The Butler, The Help.
Yeah, I shouldn't have done it. I should have just, you know.
I don't think you shouldn't, and you're getting some affirmation here. Tracy just wrote in, and Tracy, by the way, when she calls in, she speaks for all of Black America.
Oh, good. I was wondering who this year's spokesperson was.
And she simply said, Dan is not wrong about Green Book.
Well, here's the thing, too. And the reason I regret saying it was that I said it to people. There are a lot of my friends on there who I really like, and they feel very, very differently. And when anytime you tread into these waters, the thing was, at one point in the back and forth online conversation, I pointed out the fact that all of us who were arguing and counter-arguing were all white people.
Of course.
And I said, hey, I've got a great idea. What if we invite a black person or two onto this comments thread to get their opinion?
And we all shut up and listen.
And, well, I was a bit snarky, I think, in the way I did it. And here's what it comes down to, too. Those of us who are white people and who identify as liberal, we all mean well. Some of us try harder than others, but our hearts are in the right place. Is that enough for you? Probably not. But it's a start. But none of us want to see ourselves as being not only not racist, but even not racially blind or not racially aware. And so in a way, what I was doing was I was telling them in this little conversation about a silly movie winning a silly award, hey, you're not racially aware. You've got some issues in yourself. And nobody wants to hear that, especially well-meaning white liberals. We do not want to be. The worst thing you can tell a well-meaning white liberal is, which I didn't say, but the worst thing you could say is, hey, you're a racist. Oh, my God, that's the biggest insult you could ever say to those of us in this position. And I didn't say that, but I kind of creeped up to that line, and I should not have. Even if I felt it just isn't worth it, Bob. Like, I feel not good. And it's like, it's not worth it for me to not feel good that I insulted people who mean something to me. And whether I was right or wrong sort of gets shoved aside. You know, maybe the next time they won't buy a ticket to the next inevitable Oscar Beatty Green Bookie type movie. And in that regard, can I claim victory? I guess so. But I don't know. If people want to mean well, and if people want to go see a movie that makes them feel like they're doing their part.
Yeah, let me interject this, because this film also won an award. If you're inclined, and these kinds of binaries seldom happen, but let's say you live in a universe where you only get to go and see either Green Book or If Beale Street Could Talk. For the love of God, go see If Beale Street Could Talk.
That's right.
I mentioned Tracy a little bit ago. She sent me a physical hard copy of James Baldwin's If Beale Street Could Talk.
Mm. I love
God Almighty. What a book. Mm. What a book. And it's not because I'm, you know, it doesn't play on my white guilt. Mm. It plays on what all great literature, all great theater, all great drama, all great music, all great painting, all great sculpture should play on. And that is our shared common humanity. Mm. But along the way, because it's James Baldwin, it also informs, it educates, you know, just through being a story.
Yes.
About an experience that 99.9% of white people have never known and will never know.
That's right. Which is, that's why I go to movies. I want to go to places and I want to learn, I want to understand people that are just totally out of my world. I know a lot of people thought Roma was boring as shit. People, again, who I respect their opinion, I respect their taste, said, you know, I got to admit it. I just wasn't into Roma. And I understand that. It is very slow moving. It's in Spanish, the whole movie. But I loved it. And maybe it's because I've been on a foreign film kick lately, where I'm watching like Truffaut and Kurosawa. And so I was ready for it. But also, it's a world I had never, ever really thought about, let alone seen. Not just the city in Mexico, but even a real in-depth portrait of a person who all she does is clean a family's house and take care of a family's kids. And we, unlike the help, we don't cut away to the white people. We stay with that housemaid, nanny, whatever she is. We stay with her the whole movie. She's our hero. We see her, everything through her eyes. And I've never seen that to that degree in a film before. And the way that the director used the camera, he did deserve best cinematography, because it wasn't always just about making pretty sunsets. It was about where the camera goes and what it's looking at and how something is framed to make you feel a certain way or to examine a person. So I want to go to places. I don't want to go to the same place over and over, which kind of leads me to my next mini sermon, if you'll allow me, which is this.
Preach.
Preaching I will in the church of cinema. A lot of people, we all make fun of the Oscars as much as we revere them, because they are silly, they are cheesy, they are ultimately meaningless. You know, the idea of a best anything is rather silly. I was going to tell you before, and I'll tell you now, there's a quote by Humphrey Bogart, who was once asked what he thought the best way, he'd lost out best actor to somebody other. He said, you know, are you bothered by that you didn't win best actor? He would eventually win for African Queen in 1951. But he said, are you bothered by not winning Best Actor? And Bogart's reply was, well, I don't see how you can – I'm not going to do a Bogart impression. Bogart said, I don't see how you can really determine a Best Actor. I guess the only fair way to do it is to bring five guys into a room, make them all play Hamlet, and see who does it the best. And so it's like, yeah, because every – role is so different from the next. Freddie Mercury is different from Dick Cheney as anybody could be, or whoever else, you know, any actor in any movie this year.
Yeah, that'll be the next one. But no, I, you know, and Bogart, yeah, so Bogart played all those tough guys, but he was a
love Happy Time Murders, for all I know. And that doesn't mean they're wrong and I'm right. It's just what they did, what turns them on. But let me just preach over you.
Okay, please. Go right ahead.
If you didn't have the Oscars, you know, because people said, oh, why do we even have this nonsense? It's bullshit. You know, it's just actors jerking off in front of cameras. Well, why we've had this jerk off for all these years now, because it's especially important now in the past 10 years. If it weren't for the Oscars, you wouldn't have real serious attempts at serious filmmaking on any production level beyond independent cinema. You know, we'll always have somebody with $10 million or less that are going to try to examine the secrets of the universe. But the studios, if they had their way, it would be all Aquaman 2 and Justice League and remakes of stuff that was successful 20 years ago.
Or as was predicted in Idiocracy, 2 hours or an hour and, you know, an hour and 55 minutes of a shot of a guy's ass. And it would be a movie called Ass.
If that's what if people paid to see that, then most definitely you'd get Ass 2, 3, and 4. The New Beginning, you get Son of Ass. But because of the Oscars, see, because what the Oscars do is they do appeal to the egos of actors, actresses, directors, and producers. The big ones that make movies really happen. I don't have a job unless an actor or an actress or both attach themselves, commit to doing a script that they like, to commit to working with a director they like. And director, the package has to come together with those, what they call elements in the business. And you believe me, those actors, when they're up there receiving their Oscars, that's the biggest moment of their life. I mean, they say that they're watching their kids being born is bigger, but I don't believe it. I think that that moment of holding the Oscar is the biggest moment in their life because they've been imagining it their entire lives since they were children. And they'll tell you in the speech, I imagined in front of my mirror holding this, and now I get to hold this. I'd like to thank the Academy. We all want to say that, right? The only way they get to do that is to attach their names to one important attempt at a serious movie that brings in, if we can get Christian Bale and we can get, you know, whoever else, Bradley Cooper, with Amy Adams, we can get enough money to finance this movie. You know, or if we can get the rights to all the Queen songs, we don't need a huge star. I mean, Rami Malek may now be a huge star, but he wasn't then. If we can get enough elements attached, we can make the Queen story. Or whatever. If it weren't for the Oscars, we wouldn't have any of that stuff. All we'd have are tentpoles, sequels, superhero. And I like those movies. I mean, somebody accused me the other day of not liking superheroes. You know,
snob. I grew up.
Yeah, I'm a film snob. You know, I grew up on Batman. You know, I remember Superman the movie with Christopher Reeves and waiting in line at the mall to see it in 1978. But I don't want just that. It's the same way that when you eat dinner every night, sometimes you want a hamburger and fries. It's delicious. Everybody loves hamburger and fries. Well, not vegans, but let's just say metaphorically, everybody loves hamburger and fries. But if that's all you eat every day, you're going to be fat and boring, and you're going to be bored. You need every once in a while to mix it up. You need to get something. You need to put that plate of tofu in front of you. And at first you say, I'm not going to eat this shit, but try it. Just try it. And you know what? You might like it. You might not, but somebody tried to make something other than freaking hamburgers and fries. And you have to have respect for that.
Because you know, this is the metaphor you're working with. We've got a president who only likes taco bowls, fried chicken, and New York strips that have been rendered into shoe leather. How's that working out?
Huh. Well, he's certainly not a person with any curiosity beyond himself and what he sees in the mirror. Hopefully we can all be people that are better people than our supposed leader. We can be people who expand our interests. And you know what? I might hate Roma, but I should at least watch Roma. It's free on Netflix. Almost everybody has Netflix these days, right? Or at least a lot of people do. Give it a shot. You might be bored. You might not give a shit about the travails of a woman scrubbing toilets in a city in Mexico filmed in black and white, and you have to read it all. I get that. But don't just go for Aquaman 2 right off the bat. Watch Eighth Grade. There's a great movie that didn't get nominated for anything. It's one of my favorites of the year, and that was something called Sorry to Bother You. I rented it. It is one strange motherfucking movie. It's a movie by black people, you know, starring black people. but and it examines racism in America now in the most warped, I can't tell you way.
I mean, is it David Lynch weird?
It's comedy. It's absurdist. It's not David Lynch. Like, there, people have motivation, obvious motivations. People do things like normal people do. I don't know how to describe it other than saying it is one of the weirder movies I've seen in a long time. It's got a really good cast. The guy that directs his name is Boots Riley, who's a stand-up comedian. So it's funny. But by God, is it strange. And it gets super strange about two-thirds of the way. We were watching it at home over Christmas. It was one of those movies. See, whenever the four of us, my wife, me, and my two kids, my daughter and my son, whenever we watch a movie together, it's really, really hard to pick the movie. We can spend a half an hour arguing about which movie, because what we often do is by the time we the four of us collectively choose something that none of us really want to watch that much, or none of us know anything about. And that was the case with Sorry to Bother You. It's like, I don't know that much, but I hear good things. Let's just see. And at first we're like, I don't know if I like this. This is, huh? What? He's doing what? But as we got on and we kind of got into it, it's like, oh, this is really weird, but also really funny. And then two-thirds of the way through, something happens that I will not spoil, but just something happens where all of us just went, whoa, right at the TV. And how many times do you do that now with a movie where you just shout at the screen, whoa? I mean, at this point, CGI makes everything possible, so it makes it all in a way kind of boring. It's like, whoa, Aquaman got, you know, hit in the head by a flying shark that spits out fire from his nostrils. Okay, we know that was done in a computer. You know, anybody could do that with enough money, time, and resources. But to come up with some of the stuff that Boots Riley did in Sorry to Bother You, available, I believe, on rental, that's just like somebody thought of that and somebody gave him the money to do it. Wow. You know, same way with David Lynch.
And it sounds like you're the better for it.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you might watch this movie that I'm raving about right now and you're like, I don't get it. I just think this is weird and incomprehensible. But try weird and incomprehensible every once in a while. I could mention all kinds of wonderful weird movies.
Oh, like no. I've been Blue Velvet. You know, I'm not afraid of weird.
Yeah. Have you ever seen? There's a Dr. Seuss movie called, and it was made in the 50s, called The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Oh. Dr. Seuss co-wrote the movie. He wrote the screenplay, and the whole movie. Like, you know those shitty movies that came out recently with Mike Myers and Jim Carrey?
Oh.
Mention all that? And it was like, hey, what would it look like if we made a Dr. Seuss movie, only it's live action? And they were really crappy. And they looked just awful and cheesy. Well, this was in 1956, I think. It's a surreal story. A little boy is forced to take piano lessons. And while he's practicing, he falls asleep. And he dreams. The rest of the movie, like The Wizard of Oz, the rest of the movie is a dream. And the boy dreams that his evil piano teacher is the lord over this despotic kingdom. And his piano teacher's name is Dr., I think, Tutwiler. So in the dream, he's Dr. T. And Dr. T has like this fantastic, strange Dr. Seuss land where like none of the doors are 90 degrees. They're all off kilter and stairways sort of go up into infinity, or you'll climb a staircase and then it just stops and you have to like jump off. But the whole thing is Dr. T has this composition that can only be played by 500 boys all at one time at a piano. So he has this keyboard that stretches for like a half mile, and you're seeing this in a movie in the 1950s. So again, to go on my anti-CGI thing, there ain't no CGI here, folks. Somebody had to design, build, paint, etc. this keyboard that goes on for like 100 yards, and there's all these boys in front, and they're wearing these weird hats, and they're playing. They're forced to play Dr. T's composition for eternity. This is a movie. I mean, this is like, I'm telling you kind of the structure of the movie. A lot of weird things happen in it. There's twins that are attached to each other by the beard. They're like Siamese twins by the beard on roller skates. There's an S&M guy that runs the elevator. And Hans Conried, do you know who he is?
Oh, yes.
He used to do like a lot of voiceovers for the 60s cartoons. You'd know him. He's Dr. T. It's the weirdest thing in one
I have to find this. I got to find this.
You'll thank me.
I have a feeling that within a week or so, it'll probably happen on Friday, you know, because on Friday we have Friday on the Front Porch. It's a roundtable conversation that doesn't take place anywhere else on radio, where we'll get 5 or 10 or 15 people talking together. Who knows, by Friday or at some Friday on the Front Porch in the fairly immediate future, there will be a, holy shit, I watched those two movies Dan was talking about. Oh, my God. And it'll go from there.
I was thinking to myself, too, I wonder if somebody just happened to tune in right now, expecting like a good, debate about The Wall or Jussie Smollett or
yeah, not on this program.
And then instead they get this guy who's talking, who's raving for like 5 minutes about a 1956 movie starring who's Hans Conried? Oh, watch enough cartoons, you'll know what I'm talking about. Anyway, that's what I'm into. I just like to be surprised, Bob. I want to put on something and just be surprised. And I don't get that a whole lot anymore I get it more from TV now, as you and I have talked.
Yeah, but that was a topic I was going to bring up with you, and that is where, for instance, Roma or The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Right.
It used to be that it was it was a mark of failure if you were direct to video.
Yeah.
It meant you had failed utterly in your attempt to garner your costs back on movie tickets. Well, in the case of Roma and The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, straight to Netflix.
And I think in order to qualify for the Oscars, I think they had to play in theaters, in like two theaters in the country for 3 days before appearing on Netflix. I think that's the rules. It's crazy rules.
Yeah, that's sort of a de minimis standard.
Exactly.
And so I mean the business is obviously changing, and nothing is settled. This is still a transition period in absolute chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where it's going to go, but I find it really interesting. The other thing I wanted to bring up in the overall universe of Oscars is it had to be gratifying to you, I presume, to see the little mini insurgency that developed when they started talking about wanting to ditch the non-sexy categories.
That's right. Yeah. Well, yes, I was one of those people that immediately got online and did post a I signed the online petition, and I encouraged a lot of other people to do so. It's appalling. And again, it's like, well, geez, it's a stupid award. What are you whining about, you big baby? I work in a factory and I make, $6 an hour. Shut up. But this is what I never want. What's insulting to me, given that I've been working in the film industry for 33 years now, and I work with people who have also put in their time, and we put in hours, guys. At a minimum, my work day is 12 hours. It's often more, and it's outside. And again, I'm not asking for pity, because I'm not working on the highway. I'm not collecting garbage at 5 a.m. I've got a very good life in a lot of ways, but still, what we all want, no matter what we do, is we want respect, right? It's good to feel respected, and what that was felt not just for the directors of photography or the makeup artists that would have been relegated to commercials. For those of us who are called below the line, that is the grips, the electrics, the prop men, all of us that do those things that we're not the stars, we're not the director. We want respect. We want respect for our work, because we do make those movies. We're not just tools in a drawer. We bring something of ourselves into our projects, And to have it so obviously attempted to be shoved away so that, you know, the celebrities can get 30 more seconds of camera time, because that's what's going to bring the ratings up. That's, first of all, it's nonsense. It won't work. But it's so disrespectful to, I mean, a cinematographer can really make a movie. And they were going to, the idea too was going to be they were going to rotate it every year. Next year it would be the art directors or editors. It's editors can save a movie. You know, they're far, everybody's important. I don't want to put any like, well, this category is more important than that. But honestly, like Best Song, which is, you know, Shallow is a wonderful song. And it was one of the wonderful moments of last night's show. But an editor puts 2 years of his life into 14-hour, or her life, into like 14-hour days between the very beginnings of pre-production to the final print that goes out to the theaters. That can be a 2-year process. That deserves respect. You don't put that on while they're showing ads for that stupid spy show that ABC was plugging all night long. That's all we want. And look, at, I know if you, most people's jobs, you don't get awards, you don't get nominations. If it's any cold comfort to people out there, the particular craft I do, prop master, does not, I will never be eligible for.
It doesn't have a category.
It should be, it could be arguably part of art direction design. But I'm not whining about that, really. But yeah, the point is, we all deserve respect. This goes back to your the humanity stuff we're talking about with the politician. You just don't want people to treat you like you're second class citizen. And in a way, this ties in maybe even to the Green Book thing, that if we're going to tell the story of this African American piano player, maybe feature the story more about the African American piano player versus, hey, I was a racist until I met this African-American piano player, and now I'm not. That isn't really the story to me. That's not the interesting story. I was a racist, now I'm not. To me, it's, what does America look like to this guy? What does the South look to this guy? I mean, he, or anything. I just want people to look at other people with respect and humanity, and even, you know, fictional stupid movies that win awards, just dare to look at other people and consider them and treat them right. And if you don't get an award for whatever job you do out there, you know, if you're the boss of these people and you happen to be listening, which you're probably not, give them their own form of an award. Just compliment them. Just take them out to lunch one day and pick up the check. You know, stick a cake on their desk one day, whatever it is. You know, if you're at a restaurant and you get even okay service, you can put an extra buck down for a tip. A buck won't kill you. You know, it doesn't have to be 10 or 12%. It can be 20%, probably.
Not to seem too Pollyanna-ish, Dan, but it can extend as far as, and I think we've talked about this before, being decent to people you don't know with whom you interact on a fairly regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Have a moment to say, I appreciate the job you do. I've got some sense of how, and you know, this isn't me climbing up on the cross or anything, but, you know, just take a minute to share a little bit of your life with somebody else's life.
Yeah. And it's also saying, you know what, I understand, you know, I'm with you. We're all with each other. You know, I give you a buck extra this time. Maybe you give me an extra buck somewhere along the line. Use that corny phrase, you pay it forward. You give your time to somebody, and maybe they give their time to somebody else, or whatever form of value you can give. And again, I'm a Pollyanna, God knows, and one of the reasons why movies or books or even a silly pop song can have great meaning is if it inspires such thought or behavior. And listen, Jesus was a great storyteller, right? And the lessons he gave to the people as he was on the mount, right? They were parables. He came from
a storytelling tradition.
He knew that the best way to impart a lesson was to put it in story form. People could identify with a character that he would present. A man does this, so you do that. In everybody's heads, they're imagining who that man is. There is no man. You know, Jesus made it up. There is no man. He's just saying, if you do this, this happens, and that is good. That is a good thing. He's telling a story, and he's pretty darn good at it, I would guess, because they wrote, you know, a lot of a book about him. People talk about him still.
And you know, to go back for a moment to what you were saying about the people who work so-called behind the scenes, Dan. You know me. I'm one of those long view history nerd type people. Sophocles writes the Oedipus series.
Oh, that's really long the term. That's really heading back. But okay, Sophocles. Yes, sorry.
But I'll bet you Sophocles did not design the Deus Ex Machina crane that swung the god out to make the action happen. You know, the Deus Ex Machina being a critical aspect of ancient Greek drama.
I was taught Deus Ex Machina, but yes.
Well, it is.
I know you're doing the hillbilly format. I get
No, if it was hillbilly, it would have been Machina.
Mm.
But Sophocles also did not design the brooch with which Jocasta goes off stage, pulling it from her gown to Oedipus rather, pulling it from his toga to go off stage and blind himself. Somebody else did that, and so it's not anything new, and that's not to take anything away. It is to acknowledge that this has always been an art in which one never fully sees the full extent of the art involved. Sensible?
I'm chewing on it. I'm chewing on it. I'm thinking about it. Say that last sentence again. Just the last sentence, please.
This has always been an art in which one never sees the fullness of the art involved. Or the fullness of the work that goes into the art involved.
That's true. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well,
Carpenters built the Globe Theater. Shakespeare didn't.
Right. And listen, I've driven within sight of the Empire State Building. These days I'm working on a job in New Jersey. So, yes, I see the Empire State Building and many other wonderful Manhattan buildings across the river from me as I drive down the New Jersey Turnpike. And the Empire State Building is one of my... certainly my favorite building in the entire United States, and I would guess one of the favorite buildings in the world. And I don't think about every person that laid in the brick or put in a toilet or a sink or the tiling, but I can only imagine that if you were one of those people, and I'm actually related to somebody whose father was a bricklayer for many buildings, including the Empire State Building. So I sometimes think about him just as he passes it, you know, just there has to be a sense of pride in that you look and you go, I helped make that. And that's, I think I've said this on the show before, and at the risk of being corny, I have worked on a lot of really good, memorable things, that I hope and think will stick around for a while. And I have a pride in that, knowing that I had a hand in it. I put the sinks in there, you know. That's my metaphorical contribution to a movie like American Hustle or Black Swan or The Americans. I put the sinks in, or I laid down the tile. Now, I didn't design the Empire State Building, I didn't finance it, but I put some element of my craft into something that was beautiful, and that's all any of us can hope to do is to try to create beauty in whatever way we can, contribute to some way, and have a pride in that.
I'll never forget the first time that I ran across a piece of broken pottery in a pit I was digging in on an archaeological site. That first piece of pottery. Because that little piece of pottery was my key to unlock a door to think about people who had no name, whose language we do not know, whose wants, needs, desires we don't understand beyond, say, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But to wonder about that world and to care about that world and to recognize that that world had validity and value over, above, and beyond anything that even the people who spend their time worrying about it or pondering it can ever contemplate. We're all that, each and every one of us. We are, you know, whether we realize it or not, we are all flies suspended in amber. Because, you know, it ain't always going to be here. All of this ain't always going to be here.
As the great group of poets, Kansas, once said,
yes,
dust in the wind. All we are is just dust in the wind. Now, with that, I'd like the listeners to turn their hymnals to page 33.
Just as I am.
Yes. Just as I was going to go with Onward Christian Soldiers, but Just as I Am is actually better.
Well, you did get a note in from Tracy.
Oh boy.
Subject line: subject line: sorry to bother you, Dan. It took me a minute as well, and yes, it was weird as fuck. But yes, I found myself going whoa too. I love this movie because it showed that black people can make and enjoy movies that aren't the norm. And yes, that Dr. Seuss movie was like watching a black and white acid trip.
No, it's in color. It's not black and white.
Oh, okay.
She was on acid when she watched it.
Maybe,
so
yeah.
Reverse.
Or maybe it was a black and white. Maybe it was a black and white telescreen. I didn't know they were making black and white iPads, but they may. But Tracy continues and says, "I love it when you're on the program talking about movies and social consciousness. It's refreshing to hear a white man besides Bob who's just as tired of white savior movies as I am."
Huh.
By the way, if you need a black woman to chime in with your white liberal friends on your Facebook page about race issues, hit a sister up. Signed, love, Tracy, the national spokeswoman for the entire Negro race.
Wow. I'm so honored, Tracy, to be in your presence. You know, it's always funny when people get complimented. The first thing they say a lot of times is, "I feel so humbled." It's like, no, you aren't. You aren't humbled. You feel pretty damn good about yourself.
You're tickled pink. And in our case, particularly pink.
A black woman just praised me for my racial consciousness. That makes me feel really, really cool.
Yeah, it's like a little badge you can put on your posts.
All I can do is, you know, I'm trying to be enlightened. I'm going to make mistakes. Trust me, Tracy, I'm going to say something really dumb as shit sometime about somebody just like you, or something about my wonderful friends who are not heterosexual. Or I'm going to be an asshole at some point. So I treasure these moments when I actually am not. And when I meet your approval, I really actually, in all seriousness, that means a great deal to me. To know that maybe I hit at least a few of the right buttons, and maybe I am humbled by it. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I suspect you actually are. Well, you know, we've done it again, Dan. We build this as a conversation about the Oscars. You were a little bit more circumspect about it in your post about it on social media, but we hit some high points. But damn, these are good conversations. They just are.
Yeah, I had fun and I felt kind of more relaxed tonight. I'm getting used to you. I didn't use the words, you know, nearly as much as I think I have in the past. I've learned to stop interrupting you. And I think it's, you know, I sometimes wonder, like, when I do come on these things, assuming I ever come on again, I think I will, right?
I'm pretty sure, yes.
I'm pretty sure. I sometimes say, you know, should I try to get kind of heavier than, you know, going at the Hollywood Minute approach? You know what? Every once in a while, we need a little bit of the Hollywood Minute. Just don't do it all the time. Don't make that your hamburgers and fries, you know. Stick to the good hearty nutrition that Bob Kincaid brings you on a nightly basis. But every once in a while, I'm going to come in and we're going to talk about some thing maybe you never even heard of, or, you know, something from I remember when I was 6 years old. I'll sing you a cartoon theme song sometime or other. I'm sure of it.
No, you know? Carrots are divine. You get a dozen for a dime. Well, it's magic.
Magic. Yeah, sure. Well, I was thinking more like Josie and the Pussycat.
Oh, well, okay.
But that's another show, because it is by the stroke of the clock on my Apple MacBook Air, as seen in the movie Eighth Grade. It is 8:59.
It is that.
I do know where my children are. Oh, and that's my alarm telling me that it's time to take my medication to my heart.
Well, Dan, I can't thank you enough. And, yeah, I can't wait for you to come back again either. So
I so enjoy these things.
When you come back, and when you've got a little more of the skinny you can pitch on Dream, we want to hear about it, and we want to watch it.
Dream will definitely be something your listeners will be interested in. I just don't want to violate my non-disclosure agreement in any way.
Oh, no. Let's don't do that.
Because I just got a job. I sure hate to be kicked off from it.
Well, Rusty says on the way out the door, I really enjoyed your conversation with Dan tonight. I hope more of the same in the future.
I always enjoy any comment from a person whose name is Rusty. I don't know if you were given that nickname because your name is Russell, or because you have red hair, or something you might have done sexually one time that proved to be embarrassing, but yet now you laugh about. Either way, Rusty, I...
Wait a damn minute.
Oh, P.S., before I go, I finished the first draft of my novel.
You blew past that. I didn't want to interrupt you, because I'm learning not to interrupt you, too.
300-plus pages. It's a first draft. It's going to undergo a lot of work before it's all done, but... at some point or other, maybe I'll even, you know, plug it somehow or other, like people tend to do when they go on these shows. I'm not plugging a damn thing right now, but other than whatever is in my head.
Well, please give our warmest regards to your lovely wife and to both of your kids, one of whom we have spoken to.
I'm thinking the next time I do come on, maybe I bring on the lovely wife, you know. God knows, you think I have opinions? The wife, oh my God, she's got a lot of them.
Oh, I have no doubt Helene would be a lovely conversation to have.
Our marriage has what I think you would call a zesty dynamic. Let me put
it's like the old chestnut. I'd refer to that in regard to Agnes and me. We have a strange and wonderful relationship. I'm strange and she's wonderful.
And on that, what you are wonderful.
No, I'm strange. She's wonderful.
Oh, strange and adequate.
There, that. No, adequate and wonderful. I'm adequate and she's wonderful. It is time for your meds.
Well, it is time for my meds. We'll take those phrases and we'll test them at some local teens at the mall. And our firm will get back to you. You know, we got to work on your branding, Bob. Your branding is not quite up to Kardashian levels yet.
I so desperately want to be an influencer on Instagram, but like being a rock and roll singer or a painter, I sense it's not going to happen.
Okay, I feel the hook. It's come out from behind the curtains.
Yeah.
It's around my neck.
Oh, we're the boys of the chorus. We hope you like the show. Later, Dan.
Later.
See ya.
Good night. Bye.
Bye. Love you, man. The one and only, the irrepressible. How many other adjectives? How many other superlatives for the likes of Dan Fisher? Not the likes of, for Dan Fisher. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. I enjoy them immensely. I learn stuff. I close the microphone feeling better. And so, so thanks, Dan. For the generous gift of your 2 hours. Thank you so very much. And thanks to all of you who share in your precious finite time engaging in this little conversation. Thanks to all of you who support the program. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky in the chat room this evening. Thanks to our news ninjas. Thank you.
Brother Deacon Asa, head on .live. Thanks to John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Get to feeling better, brother. A little under the weather. Hey, Tara Devlin, you get to feeling better too, sister. And thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all. Titanic Tuesday tomorrow.